Cox doesn't flee. Cox approaches the dome and shouts,
"You! Officer in charge!"
Henry Morrison turns, walks to the colonel's position, and braces his hands on a hard and mystic surface he can't see. Breathing has become difficult. Bad wind pushed by the firestorm hits the dome, swirls, then backdrafts toward the hungry thing that's coming. A black wolf with red eyes. Here, on the Mottentown line, is the lambfold where it will feed.
"Help us," Henry says.
Cox looks at the firestorm and estimates it will reach the crowd's current position in no more than 15 minutes, perhaps as few as three. It's not a fire or an explosion. In this closed and already polluted environment, it is a cataclysm.
"Sir,
I cannot," he says. Before Henry can reply, Joe Boxer grabs his arm. He is gibbering.
"Quit it, Joe,"
Henry says. "There's nowhere to run and nothing to do but pray." But Joe Boxer does not pray. He is still holding his stupid little hawkshot pistol. And after a final crazed look at the oncoming inferno, he puts the gun to his temple like a man playing Russian roulette. Henry makes a grab for it, but is too late. Boxer pulls the trigger. Nor does he die at once, although a gout of blood flies from the side of his head. He staggers away, waving the stupid little pistol like a handkerchief, screaming. Then he falls to his knees, throws his hands up once to the darkening sky like a man in the grip of a Godhead revelation, and collapses face first on the broken white line of the highway. Henry turns his stunned face back to Colonel Cox, who is simultaneously 3 feet and 1,000,000 miles away.
"I'm so sorry, my friend,"
Cox says. Pamela Chen stumbles up.
"The bus," she screams to Henry over the building roar. "We have to take the bus and drive straight through it. It's our only chance."
Henry knows this is no chance at all, but he nods, gives Cox a final look. Cox will never forget the cop's hellish, despairing eyes. Takes Pammy Chen's hand and follows her to bus 19 as the smoky blackness races toward them. The fire reaches downtown and explodes along Main Street like a blowtorch in a pipe. The Peace Bridge is vaporized. Big Jim and Carter cringe in the fallout shelter as the town hall implodes above them. The PD sucks its brick walls in, then spews them high into the sky. The statue of Lucien Calvert is uprooted from its base in War Memorial Plaza. Lucien flies into the burning black with his rifle bravely raised. On the library lawn, the Halloween dummy with the jolly top hat and the garden trowel hands goes up in a sheet of flame. A great whooshing noise, it sounds like God's own vacuum cleaner, has arisen as the oxygen-hungry fire sucks in good air to fill its single poisonous lung. The buildings along Main Street explode, one after another, tossing their boards and goods and shingles and glass into the air like confetti on New Year's Eve. The abandoned movie house, Sanders' hometown drug, Burpee's department store, the gas and grocery, the bookstore, the flower shop, the barber shop. In the funeral parlor, the most recent additions to the roll of the dead begin roasting in their metal lockers like chickens in a Dutch oven. The fire finishes its triumphant run down Main Street by engulfing Food City, then rolls onward toward Dippers, where those still in the parking lot scream and clutch at each other. Their last sight on earth is of a firewall 100 yards high running eagerly to meet them, like Albion to his beloved. Now the flames are rolling down the main roads, boiling their tar into soup. At the same time, it is spreading into Eastchester, snacking on both yuppie homes and the few yuppies cowering inside. Michaela Burpee will soon run for her cellar, but too late. Her kitchen will explode around her, and her last sight on earth will be her Amana refrigerator melting. The soldiers standing by the Tarker-Chester border, closest to the origin of this catastrophe, stumble backward as the fire beats impotent fists against the dome, turning it black. The soldiers feel the heat bake through, raising the temperature 20 degrees in seconds, crisping the leaves on the nearest trees. One of them will later say, "It was like standing outside a glass ball with a nuclear explosion inside of it." Now the people cowering against the dome begin to be bombarded by dead and dying birds as the fleeing sparrows, robins, grackles, crows, gulls, and even geese slam against the dome they so quickly learn to avoid. And across Dinsmore's field comes a stampede of the town's dogs and cats. There are also skunks, woodchucks, porcupines. Deer leap among them and several clumsily galloping moose. And of course Alden Dinsmore's cattle, eyes rolling and mooing their distress. When they reach the dome, they crash against it. The lucky animals die. The unlucky ones lie sprawled on pincushions of broken bones, barking and squealing and meowing and bellowing. Ollie Dinsmore sees Dolly, the beautiful brown Swiss who once won him a 4-H blue ribbon. His mother named her, thought Ollie and Dolly was just so cute. Dolly gallops heavily toward the dome with somebody's Weimer on her nipping at her legs, which are already bloody. She hits the barrier with a crunch he can't hear over the oncoming fire. Except in his mind he can hear it. And somehow, seeing the equally doomed dog pounce on poor Dolly and begin ripping at her defenseless udder, is even worse than finding his father dead. The sight of the dying cow that was once his darling breaks the boy's paralysis. He doesn't know if there's even the slightest chance of surviving this terrible day, but he suddenly sees two things with utter clarity. One is the oxygen tank with his dead father's Red Sox cap hung on it. The other is Grampy Tom's oxygen mask dangling from the hook of the bathroom door. As Ollie runs for the farm where he's lived his whole life, the farm that will soon cease to exist, he has only one completely coherent thought. The potato cellar. Buried under the barn and running beneath the hill behind it, the potato cellar may be safe. The expatriates are still standing at the edge of the orchard. Barbie hasn't been able to make them hear him, let alone move them. Yet he must get them back to the farmhouse and the vehicles. Soon. From here they have a panoramic view of the whole town, and Barbie is able to judge the fire's course the way a general might judge the most likely route of an invading army by aerial photographs. It's sweeping southeast, and may stay on the western side of the Prestille. The river, although dry, should still serve as a natural firebreak. The explosive windstorm the fire has generated will also help to keep it from the town's northernmost quadrant. If the fire burns all the way to where the dome borders on Castle Rock and Motton, the heel and sole of the boot, then those parts of Chester's Mill bordering on TR-90 and Northern Harlow may be saved. From fire, at least. But it's not fire that concerns him. What concerns him is that wind. He feels it now rushing over his shoulders and between his spread legs hard enough to ripple his clothes and blow Julia's hair around her face. It's rushing away from them to feed the fire. And because the mill is now an almost completely closed environment, there will be very little good air to replace what is being lost. Barbie has a nightmare image of goldfish floating dead on the surface of an aquarium from which all the oxygen has been exhausted. Julia turns to him before he can grab her and points at something below, a figure trudging along Black Ridge Road, pulling a wheeled object. From this distance, Barbie can't tell if the refugee is a man or a woman, and it doesn't matter. Whoever it is will almost certainly die of asphyxiation long before reaching the highland. He takes Julia's hand and puts his lips to her ear. We have to go. Grab Piper and have her grab whoever's next to her. Everybody. What about him? She shouts, still pointing to the trudging figure. It might be a child's wagon he or she is pulling. It's loaded with something that must be heavy because the figure is bent over and moving very slowly. Barbie has to make her understand because time has grown short. Never mind him. We're going back to the farmhouse. Now. Everybody joins hands so nobody gets left behind. She tries to turn and look at him, but Barbie holds her still. He wants her ear, literally, because he has to make her understand. If we don't go now, it may be too late. We'll run out of air. On Route 117, Velma Winter leads a parade of fleeing vehicles in her Datsun truck. All she can think about is the fire and smoke filling the rearview mirror. She's doing 70 when she hits the dome, which she has in her panic forgotten completely. Just another bird, in other words. This one on the ground. The collision occurs at the same spot where Billy and Wanda DeBeck, Nora Robichaux, and Elsa Andrews came to grief a week before, shortly after the dome came down. The engine of Velma's light truck shoots backward and tears her in half. Her upper body exits through the windshield, trailing intestines like party streamers, and splatters against the dome like a juicy bug. It is the start of a 12-vehicle pileup in which many die. The majority are only injured, but they will not suffer long. Henrietta and Petra feel the heat wash against them. So do all the hundreds pressed against the dome. The wind lifts their hair and ruffles clothes that will soon be burning. "Take my hand, honey," Henrietta says, and Petra does. They watch the big yellow bus make a wide drunken turn. It totters along the ditch, barely missing Richie Killian, who first dodges away and then leaps nimbly forward, grabbing onto the back door as the bus goes by. He lifts his feet and squats on the bumper.
I hope they make it, Petra says.
So do I, honey. But I don't think they will.
Now some of the deer leaping out of the approaching conflagration are on fire. Henry has taken the wheel of the bus. Pamela stands beside him, holding onto a chrome pole. The passengers are about a dozen townsfolk, most loaded in earlier because they were experiencing physical problems. Among them are Mabel Alston, Mary Lou Costas, and Mary Lou's baby, still wearing Henry's baseball cap. The redoubtable Leo Lemoyne has also gotten on board, although his problem seems to be emotional rather than physical. He is wailing in terror.
"Step on it and head north!" Pamela shouts.
The fire has almost reached them. It's less than 500 yards ahead, and the sound of it shakes the world.
"Drive like a motherfucker and don't stop for anything!"
Henry knows it's hopeless, but because he also knows he would rather go out this way than helplessly cowering with his back to the dome, he yanks on the headlights and gets rolling. Pamela is thrown backward into the lap of Chaz Bender, the teacher. Chaz was helped into the bus when he began to suffer heart palpitations. He grabs Pammy to steady her. There are shrieks and cries of alarm, but Henry barely hears them. He knows he is going to lose sight of the road in spite of the headlights, but so what? As a cop, he has driven this stretch 1,000 times.
"Use the force, Luke," he thinks,
and actually laughs as he drives into the flaming darkness with the accelerator pedal jammed to the mat. Clinging to the back door of the bus, Richie Killian suddenly cannot breathe. He has time to see his arms catch fire. A moment later, the temperature outside the bus pops to 800 degrees, and he is burned off his perch like a fleck of meat off a hot barbecue grill. The lights running down the center of the bus are on, casting a weak luncheonette at midnight glow over the terrified, sweat-drenched faces of the passengers. But the world outside has turned dead black. Whirlpools of ash eddy in the radically foreshortened beams of the headlights. Henry steers by memory, wondering when the tires will explode beneath him. He's still laughing, although he can't hear himself over the scalded cat screech of 19's engine. He's keeping to the road, there's that much. How long until they break through the other side of the firewall? Is it possible they can break through? He's beginning to think it might be. Good God, how thick can it be?
"You're doing it!" Pamela shouts. "You're doing it!"
Maybe, Henry thinks, maybe I am. But Christ, the heat! He is reaching for the air conditioning knob, meaning to turn it all the way to max cool, and that's when the windows implode and the bus fills with fire. Henry thinks, no, no, not when we're so close. But when the charred bus charges clear of the smoke, he sees nothing beyond but a black wasteland. The trees have been burned away to glowing stubs, and the road itself is a bubbling ditch. Then an overcoat of fire drops over him from behind, and Henry Morrison knows no more. 19 skids from the remains of the road and overturns with flame spewing from every broken window. The quickly blackening message on the back reads, "Slow down, friend. We love our children." Ollie Dinsmore sprints to the barn, wearing Grampy Tom's oxygen mask around his neck and carrying two tanks with a strength he never knew he had, the second he spied as he cut through the garage. The boy runs for the stairs that will take him down to the potato cellar. There's a ripping, snarling sound from overhead as the roof begins to burn. On the west side of the barn, the pumpkins also begin to burn, the smell rich and cloying, like Thanksgiving in hell. The fire moves toward the southern side of the dome, racing through the last 100 yards. There is an explosion as Dinsmore's dairy barns are destroyed. Henrietta Clavard regards the oncoming fire and thinks, well, I'm old, I've had my life. That's more than this poor girl can say.
"Turn around, honey," she tells Petra, "and put your head on my bosom."
Petra Searles turns a tear-stained and very young face up to Henrietta's.
"Will it hurt?"
"Only for a second, honey. Close your eyes, and when you open them, you'll be bathing your feet in a cool stream."
Petra speaks her last words.
"That sounds nice."
She closes her eyes. Henrietta does the same. The fire takes them. At 1 second, they're there. At the next, gone. Cox is still close on the other side of the dome, and the cameras are still rolling from their safe position at the flea market site. Everyone in America is watching in shocked fascination. The commentators have been stunned to silence, and the only soundtrack is the fire, which has plenty to say. For a moment, Cox can still see the long human snake, although the people who make it up are only silhouettes against the fire. Most of them, like the expatriates on Black Ridge, who are at last making their way back to the farmhouse in their vehicles, are holding hands. Then the fire boils against the dome and they are gone. As if to make up for their disappearance, the dome itself becomes visible, a great charred wall rearing into the sky. It holds most of the heat in, but enough flashes out to turn Cox around and send him running. He tears off his smoking shirt as he goes. The fire has burned on the diagonal bar before Saw, sweeping across Chester's Mill from northwest to southeast. When it dies, it will do so with remarkable quickness. What it has taken is oxygen. What it leaves behind is methane, formaldehyde, hydrochloric acid, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and trace gases equally noxious. Also, choking clouds of particulate matter, vaporized houses, trees, and, of course, people. What it leaves behind is poison. 22. 28 exiles and two dogs convoyed out to where the dome bordered on TR-90, known to the old-timers as Canton. They were crammed into three vans, two cars, and the ambulance. By the time they arrived, the day had grown dark and the air had become increasingly hard to breathe. Barbie jammed on the brakes of Julia's Prius and ran to the dome, where a concerned Army lieutenant colonel and half a dozen other soldiers stepped forward to meet him. The run was short, but by the time Barbie reached the red band spray-painted on the dome, he was gasping. The good air was disappearing like water down a sink. "The fans!" he panted at the lieutenant colonel. "Turn on the fans!" Claire McClatchy and Joe spilled out of the department store van, both of them staggering and gasping. The phone company van came next. Ernie Calvert got out, took two steps, and went to his knees. Nori and her mother tried to help him to his feet. Both were crying. "Colonel Barbara, what happened?" the lieutenant colonel asked. According to the name strip on his fatigues, he was Stringfellow. "Report!"
"Fuck your report," Romy shouted.
He was holding a semi-conscious child, Aiden Appleton, in his arms. Thirst Marshall staggered along behind him with his arm around Alice, whose sparkle-sprinkled top was sticking to her. She'd retched down her front.
"Fuck your report, just turn on those fans, you!"
Stringfellow gave the order, and the refugees knelt, their hands pressed against the dome. Greedily gasping in the faint breeze of clean air, the huge fans were able to force through the barrier. Behind them, the fire raged.
Survivors.
1. Only 397 of the mill's 2,000 residents survived the fire, most of them in the northeast quadrant of town. By the time night falls, rendering the smudged darkness inside the dome complete, there will be 106. When the sun comes up on Saturday morning, shining weakly through the only part of the dome not charred completely black, the population of Chester's Mill is just 32. 2. Ollie slammed the door to the potato cellar before running downstairs. He also flicked the switch that turned on the lights, not knowing if they would still work. They did. As he stumbled down to the barn's basement, chilly now, but not for long, he could already feel the heat starting to push in behind him. Ollie remembered the day 4 years ago when the guys from Ives Electric in Castle Rock backed up to the barn to unload the new Honda generator.
"Overpriced son of a whore, better work right,"
Alden had said, chewing on a piece of grass.
"Because I'm in hock up to my eyeballs for it."
It had worked right. It was still working right, but Ollie knew it wouldn't much longer. The fire would take it as the fire had taken everything else. If he had as much as a minute of light left, he would be surprised. "I may not even be alive in a minute." The potato grater stood in the middle of the dirty concrete floor, a complexity of belts and chains and gears that looked like some ancient instrument of torture. Beyond it was a huge pile of spuds. It had been a good fall for them, and the Dinsmores had finished the harvest only 3 days before the dome came down. In an ordinary year, Alden and his boys would have graded them all through November to sell at the Castle Rock Co-op Produce Market and various roadside stands in Motton, Harlow, and Tarker's Mills.
No Spud money this year, but Ollie thought they might save his life. He ran to the edge of the pile, then stopped to examine the two tanks. The dial on the one from the house read only half full, but the needle on the one from the garage was all the way in the green. Ollie let the half-full one clank to the concrete and attached the mask to the one from the garage. He had done this many times when Grampy Tom was alive, and it was the work of seconds. Just as he hung the mask around his neck again, the lights went out. The air was growing warmer. He dropped to his knees and began burrowing into the cold weight of the potatoes, pushing with his feet, protecting the long tank with his body and yanking it along beneath him with one hand. With the other, he made awkward swimming motions. He heard potatoes avalanche down behind him and fought a panicky urge to back out. It was like being buried alive, and telling himself that if he wasn't buried alive, he'd surely die didn't help much. He was gasping, coughing, seeming to breathe in as much potato dirt as air. He clapped the oxygen mask over his face and... nothing. He fumbled at the tank valve for what seemed like forever, his heart pounding in his chest like an animal in a cage. Red flowers began to open in the darkness behind his eyes. Cold vegetable weight bore down on him. He had been crazy to do this, as crazy as Rory had been shooting off a gun at the dome, and he was going to pay the price. He was going to die. Then his fingers finally found the valve. At first it wouldn't turn, and he realized he was trying to spin it the wrong way. He reversed his fingers, and a rush of cool, blessed air gusted into the mask. Ollie lay under the potatoes, gasping. He jumped a little when the fire blew in the door at the top of the stairs. For a moment, he could actually see the dirty cradle he lay in. It was getting warmer, and he wondered if the half-full tank he had left behind would blow. He also wondered how much additional time the full one had bought him, and if it was worth it. But that was his brain. His body had only one imperative, and that was life. Ollie began to crawl deeper into the potato pile, dragging the tank along, adjusting the mask on his face each time it came askew. 3. If the Vegas bookies had given odds on those likely to survive the Visitor's Day catastrophe, those on Sam Verdreau would have been 1,000 to 1. But longer odds have been beaten. It's what keeps bringing people back to the tables. And Sam was the figure Julia had spotted laboring along Black Ridge Road shortly before the expatriates ran for the vehicles at the farmhouse. Sloppy Sam, the canned heat man, lived for the same reason Ollie did. He had oxygen. 4 years ago, he had gone to see Dr. Haskell, the Whiz. You remember him? When Sam said he couldn't seem to catch his breath just lately, Dr. Haskell listened to the old rumpot's wheezing respiration and asked him how much he smoked.
Well, Sam had said, I used to go through as much as 4 packs a day when I was in the woods, but now that I'm on disability and sociable security, I've cut back some.
Dr. Haskell asked him what that meant in terms of actual consumption. Sam said he guessed he was down to 2 packs a day. American Eagles.
I used to smoke Chester Foggies, but now they only come with a filter, he explained. Also, they're expensive. Eagles is cheap, and you can pick the filter off before you light up. Easy as pie.
Then he began to cough. Dr. Haskell found no lung cancer, something of a surprise. But the x-rays seemed to show a damn fine case of emphysema, and he told Sam that he'd probably be using oxygen for the rest of his life. It was a bad diagnosis, but give the guy a break. As the doctors say, when you hear hoofbeats, you don't think zebras. Also, folks have a tendency to see what they're looking for, don't they? And although Dr. Haskell died what might be called a hero's death, no one, including Rusty Everett, ever mistook him for Gregory House. What Sam actually had was bronchitis, and it cleared up not too long after the Whiz made his diagnosis. By then, however, Sam was signed up for oxygen deliveries every week from Castles in the Air, a company based in Castle Rock, of course, and he never canceled the service. Why would he? Like his hypertension medicine, the oxygen was covered by what he referred to as the medical. Sam didn't really understand the medical, but he understood that the oxygen cost him nothing out of pocket. He also discovered that huffing pure oxygen had a way of cheering a body up. Sometimes, however, weeks would pass before it crossed Sam's mind to visit the scourgy little shed he thought of as the oxygen bar.
Then when the guys from Castles in the Air came to retrieve the empties, a thing they were often lax about, Sam would go out to his oxygen bar, open the valves, run the tanks dry, pile them in his son's old red wagon, and trundle them out to the bright blue truck with the air bubbles on it. If he had still lived out on Little Bitch Road, site of the old Verdreau home place, Sam would have burned to a crisp, as Marta Edmonds did, in the minutes after the initial explosion. But the home place and the woodlots which had once surrounded it had been taken for unpaid taxes long since, and purchased back in 08 by one of several Jim Rennie dummy corporations at bargain basement rates. His baby sis owned a little patch of land out on God Creek, however, and that was where Sam was residing on the day the world blew up. The shack wasn't much, and he had to do his business in an outhouse. The only running water was supplied by an old hand pump in the kitchen. But by gory, the taxes were paid, little sis saw to that, and he had the medical. Sam was not proud of his part in instigating the Food City riot. He had drunk many shots and beers with Georgia Rue's father over the years, and felt bad about hitting the man's daughter in the face with a rock. He kept thinking about the sound that piece of quartz had made when it connected, and how Georgia's broken jaw had sagged, making her look like a ventriloquist dummy with a busted mouth. He could have killed her by the living Jesus. It was probably a miracle that he hadn't. Not that she had lasted long. And then an even sadder idea had occurred to him. If he'd left her alone, she wouldn't have been in the hospital. And if she hadn't been in the hospital, she'd probably still be alive. If you looked at it that way, he had killed her. The explosion at the radio station caused him to sit bolt upright out of a drunken sleep, clutching his chest and staring around wildly. The window above his bed had blown out. In fact, every window in the place had blown out, and his shack's west-facing front door had been torn clean off its hinges. He stepped over it and stood frozen in his weedy and tire-strewn front yard staring west, where the whole world appeared to be on fire. 4. In the fallout shelter below where the town hall had once stood, the generator, small, old-fashioned, and now the only thing standing between the occupants and the great hereafter, ran steadily. Battery-powered lights cast a yellowish glow from the corners of the main room. Carter was sitting in the only chair, Big Jim taking up most of the elderly two-person sofa, and eating sardines from a can, plucking them out, one by one, with his thick fingers, and laying them on saltines. The two men had little to say to each other. The portable TV Carter had found gathering dust in the bunk room took up all of their attention. It got only a single station, WMTW out of Poland Spring. But one was enough. Too much, really. The devastation was hard to comprehend. Downtown had been destroyed. Satellite photos showed that the woods around Chester Pond had been reduced to slag, and the visitors' day crowd at 119 was now dust in a dying wind. To a height of 20,000 feet, the dome had become visible, an endless sooty prison wall surrounding a town that was now 70% burned over. Not long after the explosion, the temperature in the cellar had begun to climb appreciably. Big Jim told Carter to turn on the air conditioning. "Will the Jenny handle that?" Carter had asked. "If it won't, we'll cook," Big Jim had replied irritably. "So what's the difference?" "Don't you snap at me," Carter thought. "Don't you snap at me when you were the one who made this happen. The one who's responsible." He'd gotten up to find the air conditioning unit, and as he did, another thought crossed his mind. Those sardines really stank. He wondered what the boss would say if he told him the stuff he was putting in his mouth smelled like old dead pussy. But Big Jim had called him son like he meant it, so Carter kept his mouth shut. And when he turned on the air conditioner, it had started right up. The sound of the generator had deepened a little, though, as it shouldered the extra burden. It would burn through their supply of LP that much quicker. "Doesn't matter, he's right, we gotta have it," Carter told himself, as he watched the relentless scenes of devastation on the TV. The majority were coming from satellites or high-flying reconnaissance planes. At lower levels, most of the dome had become opaque. But not, he and Big Jim discovered, at the northeastern end of town. Around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the coverage abruptly switched there, with video coming from just beyond a bustling army outpost in the woods.
This is Jake Tapper in TR-90, an unincorporated township just north of Chester's Mill. This is as close as we've been allowed, but as you can see, there are survivors. I repeat, there are survivors.
There's survivors right here, you dummy, Carter said.
Shut up, Big Jim said.
Blood was mounting in his heavy cheeks and dashing across his forehead in a wavy line. His eyes bulged in their sockets and his hands were clenched.
That's Barbara. It's that son of a buck, Dale Barbara.
Carter saw him among the others. The picture was being transmitted from a camera with an extremely long lens, which made the image shaky. It was like looking at people through a heat haze, but it was still clear enough. Barbara, the mouthy minister, the hippie doctor, a bunch of kids, the Everett woman. That bitch was lying all along, he thought. She lied, and stupid Carter believed her. The roaring sound you hear is not helicopters, Jake Tapper was saying. If we can pull back a little... The camera pulled back, revealing a line of huge fans on dollies, each connected to its own generator. The sight of all that power just miles away made Carter feel sick with envy. You see it now, Tapper went on. Not helicopters, but industrial fans. Now, if we can move in again on the survivors... The camera did so. They were kneeling or sitting at the edge of the dome directly in front of the fans. Carter could see their hair moving in the breeze. Not quite rippling, but definitely moving. Like plants in a lazy underwater current.
There's Julia Shumway, Big Jim marveled. I should have killed that Rhymes with Witch when I had the chance.
Carter paid no attention. His eyes were riveted on the TV. The combined blast from 4 dozen fans should be enough to knock those folks over, Charlie, Jake Tapper said. But from here it looks like they're getting just enough air to keep them alive in an atmosphere that has become a poison soup of carbon dioxide, methane, and God knows what else. Our experts are telling us that Chester's Mill's limited supply of oxygen mostly went to feed the fire. One of those experts, chemistry professor Donald Irving of Princeton, told me via cell phone that the air inside the dome now might not be all that much different from the atmosphere of Venus. The picture switched to a concerned-looking Charlie Gibson, safe in New York. Lucky bastard, Carter thought. Any word yet on what may have caused the fire? Back to Jake Tapper. And then to the survivors in their small capsule of breathable air. None, Charlie. It was some sort of explosion, that seems clear, but there's been no further word from the military and nothing from Chester's Mill. Some of the people you see on your screen must have phones, but if they are communicating, it's only with Colonel James Cox, who touched down here about 45 minutes ago and immediately conferenced with the survivors. While the camera pans this grim scene from our admittedly remote standpoint, let me give concerned viewers in America and all over the world the names of the people now at the dome who have been positively identified. I think you might have still pictures of several, and maybe you can flash them on the screen as I go. I think my list's alphabetical, but don't hold me to that.
We won't, Jake.
And we do have some pictures, but go slow. Colonel Dale Barbara, formerly Lieutenant Barbara, United States Army. A picture of Barbie in desert camo came on the screen. He had his arm around a grinning Iraqi boy. A decorated veteran and most recently a short-order cook in the town restaurant. Angelina Buffalino, do we have a picture of her? No? Okay. Romeo Burpee, owner of the local department store. There was a picture of Romy. In it he was standing beside a backyard barbecue with his wife and wearing a t-shirt that read, "Kiss me, I'm French." Ernest Calvert, his daughter Joan, and Joan's daughter, Eleanor Calvert. This picture looked like it had been taken at a family reunion. There were Calverts everywhere. Nori, looking both grim and pretty, had her skateboard under one arm. Alva Drake. Her son Benjamin Drake.
Turn that off, Big Jim grunted. At least they're in the open, Carter said wistfully. Not stuck in a hole. I feel like Saddam fucking Hussein when he was on the run.
Eric Everett, his wife Linda, and their 2 daughters.
Another family,
Charlie Gibson said in a voice of approval that was almost Mormon-esque. That was enough for Big Jim. He got up and snapped the TV off himself with a hard twist of the wrist. He was still holding the sardine can and spilled some of the oil on his pants when he did it.
You'll never get that out, Carter thought, but did not say. I was watching that show, Carter thought, but did not say. The newspaper woman, Big Jim brooded, sitting back down. The cushions hissed as they collapsed beneath his weight.
She was always against me. Every trick in the book, Carter. Every trick in the cotton-picking book. Get me another can of sardines, would you?
Get it yourself, Carter thought, but did not say. He got up and grabbed another can of deans. Instead of commenting on the olfactory association he had made between sardines and deceased female sex organs, he asked what seemed to be the logical question. What are we going to do, boss? Big Jim removed the key from the bottom of the can, inserted it in the tab, and unrolled the top to expose a fresh squadron of dead fish. They gleamed greasily in the glow of the emergency lights.
Wait for the air to clear, then go topside and start picking up the pieces, son.
He sighed, placed a dripping fish on a saltine, and ate it. Cracker crumbs stuck to his lips in beads of oil.
It's what people like us always do, the responsible people, the ones who pull the plow.
What if the air doesn't clear? The TV said,
oh dear, the sky is falling, oh dear, the sky is falling.
Big Jim declaimed in a strange and strangely disturbing falsetto.
They've been saying it for years, haven't they? The scientists and the bleeding heart liberals. World War III, nuclear reactors melting down in the center of the earth. Y2K computer freezes, the end of the ozone layer, melting ice caps, killer hurricanes, global warming. Chicken, dirt, weak sister atheists who won't trust in the will of a loving, caring God, who refuse to believe there is such a thing as a loving, caring God.
Big Jim pointed a greasy but adamant finger at the younger man.
Contrary to the beliefs of the secular humanists, the sky is not falling. They can't help the yellow streak that runs up their backs, son. The guilty man flees where none pursueth, you know, Book of Leviticus. But that doesn't change God's truth. Those who believe on him shall not tire, but shall mount up with wings as eagles, Book of Isaiah. That's basically smog out there. It'll just take a while to clear out.
But 2 hours later, at just past 4 o'clock on that Friday afternoon, a shrill queep, queep, queep sound came from the alcove that held the fallout shelter's mechanical support system.
What's that? Carter asked.
Big Jim now slumped on the couch with his eyes partly closed, and sardine grease on his jowls, sat up and listened.
Air purifier, he said, kind of like a big ionic breeze. We've got one of those in the car showroom down at the store. Good gadget. Not only does it keep the air nice and sweet, it stops those static electricity shocks you tend to get in cold wet.
If the air in town's clearing, why did the purifier start up?
Why don't you go upstairs, Carter? Crack the door a little bit, see how things are. Would that ease your mind?
Carter didn't know if it would or not, but he knew just sitting here was making him feel squirrely. He mounted the stairs. As soon as he was gone, Big Jim got up himself and went to the line of drawers between the stove and the little refrigerator. For such a big man, he moved with surprising speed and quiet. He found what he was looking for in the third drawer. He glanced over his shoulder to make sure he was still alone, then helped himself. On the door at the top of the stairs, Carter was confronted by a rather ominous sign. Do you need to check the radiation count?
Think.
Carter thought, and the conclusion he came to was that Big Jim was almost certainly full of shit about the air clearing out. Those folks lined up in front of the fans proved that the air exchange between Chester's mill and the outside world was almost nil.
Still, it wouldn't do any harm to check.
At first the door wouldn't budge. Panic, sparked by dim thoughts of being buried alive, made him push harder. This time the door moved just a little. He heard bricks falling and lumber scraping. Maybe he could open it wider, but there was no reason to. The air coming in through the inch-wide gap he'd opened wasn't air at all, but something that smelled like the inside of an exhaust pipe when the motor it was attached to was running. He didn't need any fancy instruments to tell him that 2 or 3 minutes outside the shelter would kill him. The question was, what was he going to tell Rennie?
Nothing, the cold voice of the survivor inside suggested.
Hearing something like that will only make him worse. Harder to deal with.
And what exactly did that mean?
What did it matter if they were going to die in the fallout shelter when the generator ran out of fuel? If that was the case, what did anything matter? He went back down the stairs. Big Jim was sitting on the sofa.
Well, pretty bad, Carter said. But breathable, right? Well, yeah, but it'd make you damn sick. We better wait, boss. Of course we'd better wait, Big Jim said, as if Carter had suggested otherwise. As if Carter were the biggest fool in the universe.
But we'll be fine, that's the point. God will take care, he always does. In the meantime, we've got good air down here, it's not too hot, and there's plenty to eat. Why don't you see what there is for sweets, son? Candy bars and such. I'm still feeling peckish.
I'm not your son is dead, Carter thought, but didn't say. He went into the bunk room to see if there were any candy bars on the shelves in there. 5. Around 10 o'clock that night, Barbie fell into a troubled sleep with Julia close beside him, their bodies spooned together. Junior Rennie danced through his dreams. Junior standing outside his cell in the coop, Junior with his gun, and this time there would be no rescue because the air outside had turned to poison and everyone was dead. These dreams finally slipped away and he slept more deeply, his head and Julia's cocked toward the dome and the fresh air seeping through it. It was enough for life, but not enough for ease. Something woke him around 2 o'clock in the morning. He looked through the smudged dome at the muted lights of the army encampment on the other side. Then the sound came again. It was coughing, low and harsh and desperate. A flashlight gleamed off to his right. Barbie got up as quietly as he could, not wanting to wake Julia, and walked to the light, stepping over others who lay sleeping in the grass. Most had stripped down to their underwear. The sentries 10 feet away were bundled up in duffel coats and gloves, but over here it was hotter than ever. Rusty and Ginny were kneeling beside Ernie Calvert. Rusty had a stethoscope around his neck and an oxygen mask in his hand. It was attached to a small red bottle marked CRH Ambulance Do Not Remove, Always Replace. Nori and her mother looked on anxiously, their arms around each other.
Sorry he woke you, Joni said.
He's sick.
How sick? Barbie asked.
Rusty shook his head.
I don't know. It sounds like bronchitis or a bad cold, but of course it's not. It's bad air. I gave him some from the ambo, and it helped for a while, but now...
He shrugged.
And I don't like the sound of his heart. He's been under a lot of stress, and he's not a young man anymore.
You have no more oxygen? Barbie asked.
He pointed to the red bottle, which looked quite a lot like the kind of fire extinguisher people keep in their kitchen utility closets, and always forget to recharge.
That's it?
Thirst Marshall joined them. In the beam of the flashlight, he looked grim and tired.
There's one more, but we agreed, Rusty, Ginny, and me, to save it for the little kids.
Aiden started to cough, too. I moved him as close to the dome and the fans as I could, but he's still coughing. We'll start giving Aiden, Alice, Judy, and Janelle the remaining air in ration whiffs when they wake up. Maybe if the officers brought more fans.
No matter how much fresh air they blow at us, Ginny said, only so much comes through, and no matter how close to the dome we get, we're still breathing in that crap. And the people who are hurting are exactly the ones you'd expect.
The oldest and the youngest, Barbie said.
Go back and lie down, Barbie, Rusty said. Save your strength. There's nothing you can do here.
Can you?
Maybe. There's also nasal decongestant in the ambo, and epinephrine, if it comes to that.
Barbie crawled back along the dome with his head turned to the fans. They were all doing this now, without thinking. I was appalled by how tired he felt when he reached Julia. His heart was pounding and he was out of breath. Julia was awake.
How bad is he?
I don't know, Barbie admitted, but it can't be good. They were giving him oxygen from the ambulance and he didn't wake up.
Oxygen? Is there more? How much?
He explained, and was sorry to see the light in her eyes dim a little. She took his hand. Her fingers were sweaty but cold.
This is like being trapped in a mine cave-in.
They were sitting now, facing each other, shoulders leaning against the dome.
the faintest of breezes sighed between them. The steady roar of the Air Max fans had become background noise. They raised their voices to speak over it, but otherwise didn't notice it at all.
We'd notice it if it stopped, Barbie thought. For a few minutes, anyway. Then we wouldn't notice anything. Ever again.
She smiled wanly. Quit worrying about me, if that's what you're doing. I'm okay for a middle-aged Republican lady who can't quite catch her breath. At least I managed to get myself rogered one more time. Right, good, and proper, too.
Barbie smiled back. It was my pleasure, believe me.
What about the pencil nuke? They're going to try on Sunday. What do you think?
I don't think. I only hope.
And how high are your hopes? He didn't want to tell her the truth. But the truth was what she deserved.
Based on everything that's happened and the little we know about the creatures running the box?
Not very. Tell me you haven't given up.
That I can do. I'm not even as scared as I probably should be. I think because it's insidious. I've even gotten used to the stench.
Really?
He laughed. No. How about you? Scared?
Yes, but sad, mostly. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a gasp. She coughed again, curling a fist to her mouth.
Barbie could hear other people doing the same thing. One would be the little boy who was now Thurston Marshall's little boy. He'll get some better stuff in the morning, Barbie thought, and then remembered how Thurston had put it. Air in rationed whiffs. That was no way for a kid to have to breathe. No way for anyone to have to breathe. Julia spat into the grass, then faced him again.
I can't believe we did this to ourselves. The things running the box, the leatherheads, set up the situation, but I think they're only a bunch of kids watching the fun. Playing the equivalent of a video game, maybe. They're outside. We're inside. And we did it to ourselves.
You've got enough problems without beating yourself up on that score, Barbie said. If anyone's responsible, it's Rennie. He's the one who set up the drug lab, and he's the one who started raiding propane from every source in town. He's also the one who sent men out there and caused some sort of confrontation, I'm sure of it.
But who elected him? Julia asked. Who gave him the power to do those things?
Not you. Your newspaper campaigned against him, or am I wrong?
You're right, she said, but only about the last 8 years or so. At first, the Democrat, me, in other words, thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. By the time I found out what he really was, he was entrenched. And he had poor, smiling, stupid Andy Sanders out front to run interference for him.
You still can't blame.
I can and do. If I'd known that pugnacious, incompetent son of a bitch might end up in charge during an actual crisis, I'd have drowned him like a kitten in a sack.
He laughed, then started coughing. You sound less like a Republican all the time. He began, then broke off.
What? She asked.
And then she heard it, too. Something was rattling and squeaking in the dark. It got closer, and they saw a shambling figure tugging a child's wagon.
Who's there?
Called Dougie Twitchell. When the shambling newcomer answered, his voice was slightly muffled. By an oxygen mask of his own, it turned out.
Well, thank God, Sloppy Sam said. I had me a little nap side of the road, and I thought I'd run out of air before I got up here. But here I am. Just in time, too, because I'm almost tapped out.
6. The army encampment at Route 119 in Motton was a sad place that early Saturday morning. Only 36 military personnel and one Chinook remained. A dozen men were loading in the big tents, and a few leftover Air Max fans that Cox had ordered to the south side of the dome as soon as the explosion had been reported. The fans had never been used. By the time they arrived, there was no one to appreciate the scant air they could push through the barrier. The fire was out by 6 p.m., strangled by lack of fuel and oxygen, but everyone on the Chester's Mill side was dead. The medical tent was being taken down and rolled up by a dozen men. Those not occupied with that task had been set to that most ancient of army jobs, policing up the area. It was make work. But no one on the ship patrol minded.
Nothing could make them forget the nightmare they had seen the previous afternoon. But grubbing up the wrappers, cans, bottles, and cigarette butts helped a little. Soon enough it would be dawn and the big Chinook would fire up. They'd climb aboard and go somewhere else. The members of this ragtag crew absolutely could not wait. One of them was PFC Clint Ames from Hickory Grove, South Carolina. He had a green plastic hefty bag in one hand and was moving slowly through the beaten down grass, picking up the occasional discarded sign or flattened Coke can so that if hard-ass Sergeant Groh glanced over, he'd look like he was working. He was nearly asleep on his feet, and at first he thought the knocking he heard, it sounded like knuckles on a thick Pyrex dish, was part of a dream. It almost had to be, because it seemed to be coming from the other side of the dome. He yawned and stretched with one hand pressing into the small of his back. As he was doing this, the knocking resumed. It really was coming from behind the blackened wall of the dome. Then, a voice, weak and disembodied, like the voice of a ghost. It gave him the chills.
Is anybody there? Can anybody hear me? Please. I'm dying.
Christ, did he know that voice? It sounded like... Ames dropped his litter bag and ran to the dome. He put his hands on its blackened, still warm surface. Cow kid? Is that you? I'm crazy, he thought. It can't be. No one could have lived through that firestorm.
Ames! Sergeant Groh bawled. What the hell are you doing over there?
He was about to turn away when the voice behind the charred surface came again.
It's me. Don't...
There was a ragged series of barking coughs.
Don't go. If you're there, Private Ames, don't go.
Now a hand appeared. It was as ghostly as the voice, the fingers smeared with soot. It was rubbing a clean place on the inside of the dome. A moment later, a face appeared. At first, Ames didn't recognize the cow kid. Then he realized the boy was wearing an oxygen mask.
I'm almost out of air, the cow kid wheezed. Dials in the red. Has been... for the last half hour.
Ames stared into the cow kid's haunted eyes, and the cow kid stared back. Then a single imperative rose in Ames's mind. He couldn't let the cow kid die. Not after all he had survived. Although how he had survived was impossible for Ames to imagine.
Kid, listen to me. Y'all drop down on your knees and...
Ames, you useless fuckdub!
Sergeant Groh hollered, striding over.
Stop gold-bricking and get busy! I have zero patience for your weak-ass shit tonight.
PFC Ames ignored him. He was entirely fixed on the face that appeared to be staring at him from behind a grimy glass wall.
Drop down and scrape the gluck off the bottom. Do it now, kid, right now.
The face dropped from view, leaving Ames to hope the cow kid was doing as he'd been told and hadn't just passed out. Sergeant Groh's hand fell on his shoulder.
Are you deaf? I told you...
Get the fans, Sergeant. We have to get the fans.
What are you talking about?
Ames screamed into the dreaded Sergeant Groh's face.
There's somebody alive in there!
7. Only a single oxygen tank remained in the red wagon by the time Sloppy Sam arrived at the refugee camp by the dome, and the needle on the dial was resting just above zero. He made no objection when Rusty took the mask and clapped it over Ernie Calvert's face, only crawled to the dome next to where Barbie and Julia were sitting. There the new arrival got down on all fours and breathed deeply. Horace the corgi, sitting at Julia's side, looked at him with interest. Sam rolled over on his back.
It ain't much, but better than what I had. The last little bit of them tanks never tastes good, like it does fresh off the top.
Then, incredibly, he lit a cigarette.
Put that out. Are you insane? Julia said.
Been dying for one,
Sam said, inhaling with satisfaction.
Can't smoke around oxygen, you know. Blow yourself up, likely as not, although there's people who does it.
Might as well let him go, Romy said. Can't be any worse than the crap we're breathing. For all we know, the tar and nicotine in his lungs is protecting him.
Rusty came over and sat down. That tank's a dead soldier, he said, but Ernie got a few extra breaths from it. He seems to be resting easier now, thanks, Sam.
Sam waved it away.
Myers, your error, Doc. Or at least it was. Say, can't you make more with something in your ambulance there? The guys who bring my tanks, who did anyway, before this sack of shit hit the fan, they could make more right in their truck. They had a what do you call it? Pump of some kind.
Oxygen extractor, Rusty said, and you're right, we have one on board. Unfortunately, it's broken. He showed his teeth and whipped past for a grin. It's been broken for the last 3 months.
Four,
Twitch said, coming over.
He was looking at Sam's cigarette.
Don't suppose you got any more of those, do you?
Don't even think about it, Jenny said.
Afraid of polluting this tropical paradise with secondary smoke, darling? Twitch asked.
But when Sloppy Sam held out his battered pack of American Eagles, Twitch shook his head. Rusty said, I put in the request for a replacement O2 extractor myself to the hospital board. They say the budget's maxed out, but maybe I can get some help from the town. So I send the request to the board of selectmen.
Rennie, Piper Libby said.
Rennie, Rusty agreed. I get a form letter back saying my request will be taken up at the budget meeting in November.
So, I guess we'll see then.
He flapped his hands at the sky and laughed.
Others were gathering around now, looking at Sam with curiosity, and at his cigarette with horror.
How'd you get here, Sam? Barbie asked. Sam was more than happy to tell his tale. He began with how, as a result of the emphysema diagnosis, he'd wound up getting regular oxygen deliveries thanks to the medical, and how sometimes the full tanks backed up on him. He told about hearing the explosion and what he'd seen when he went outside.
I knew what was going to happen as soon as I saw how big it was, he said.
His audience now included the military on the other side. Cox, dressed in boxer shorts and a khaki undershirt, was among them.
I've seen bad fires before, back when I was working in the woods. A couple of times, we had to drop everything and just outrun them. And if one of those old international harvester trucks we had in those days had a bogged down, we never would have. Crown fires is the worst, because they make their own wind. I seen right away the same was going to happen with this one. Something almighty big exploded. What was it?
Propane, Rose said.
Sam stroked his white stubble chin.
Aye, ah, but propane wasn't all. There was chemicals, too, because some of those flames was green. If it had come my way, I would have been done. You folks, too. But it sucked south instead. Shape of the land had something to do with it. I shouldn't wonder. And the riverbed, too. Anyways, I knew what was going to happen, and I got the tanks out of the oxygen bar.
The what? Barbie asked. Sam took a final drag on his cigarette, then butted it in the dirt.
Oh, that's just the name I give to the shed where I keep them tanks. Anyway, I had five full ones.
Five?
Thurston Marshall almost moaned.
Ah, yeah, Sam said cheerfully, but I never could have drugged five. I'm getting on in years, you know.
Couldn't you have found a car or a truck? Lissa Jameson asked.
Ma'am, I lost my driving license 7 years ago. Or maybe it was eight. Too many DUIs. If I got caught behind the wheel of anything bigger in a go-kart again, they'd put me in county and throw away the key.
Barbie considered pointing out the fundamental flaw in this, but why bother wasting breath when breath was now so hard to come by?
Anyway, four tanks and that little red wagon of mine I thought I could manage, and I hadn't gone but a quarter of a mile before I started pulling on the first one.
Had to, don't you see?
Jackie Weddington asked, did you know we were out here?
No, ma'am. It was high ground, that's all, and I knew my canned air wouldn't last forever. I didn't guess about you, and I didn't guess about those fans, either. It was just a case of nowhere else to go.
What took you so long? Pete Freeman asked.
It can't be much more than 3 miles between God Creek and here.
Well, that's a funny thing, Sam said. I was coming up the road, you know Black Ridge Road, and I got over the bridge, okay, still sucking on the first tank, although it was getting almighty hot, and say, did you folks see that dead bear, the one that looked like it bashed its own brains out on a phone pole?
We saw it, Rusty said. Let me guess, a little way past the bear you got woozy and passed out.
How'd you know that?
We came that way.
Rusty said, and there's some kind of force working out there. It seems to hit kids and old people hardest.
I ain't that old, Sam said, sounding offended. I just went white hair early, like my mom.
How long were you knocked out? Barbie asked.
Well, I don't wear no watch, but it was dark when I finally got going again, so it was quite a while. I woke up once on account of I couldn't hardly breathe, switched to one of the fresh tanks and went back to sleep again. Crazy, huh? And the dreams I had. Like a three-ring circus. Last time I woke up, I was really awake. It was dark, and I went on to another tank. Making the switch wasn't a bit hard because it wasn't really dark. Should have been. Should have been darker than a tomcat's asshole with all the soot that fire flang on the dome. But there's a bright patch down there where I laid up. You can't see it in daylight, but at night it's like about a billion fireflies.
The glow belt, we call it, Joe said.
He and Nori and Benny were bunched together. Benny was coughing into his hand.
Good name for it, Sam said approvingly. Anyway, I knew somebody was up here because by then I could hear those fans and see the lights.
He nodded toward the encampment on the other side of the dome.
Didn't know if I was going to make it before my air ran out. That hill's a bugger, and I sucked up the O2 like nobody's business, but I did.
He was looking curiously at Cox.
Hey there, Colonel Clink.
I can see your breath. You best either put on a coat or come over here where it's warm.
He cackled, showing a few surviving teeth.
It's Cox, not Clink, and I'm fine.
Julia asked, what did you dream, Sam?
Funny you should ask, he said, because there's only one I can remember out of the whole bunch, and that was about you. You was laying on the bandstand in the common, and you was crying.
Julia squeezed Barbie's hand in hard, but her eyes never left Sam's face. How did you know it was me?
Because you was covered with newspapers, Sam said. Issues of the Democrat. You was hugging him against you like you was naked underneath, begging your pardon, but you asked. Ain't that just about the funniest dream you ever heard?
Cox's walkie-talkie beeped three times. Break, break, break. He took it off his belt.
What is it? Talk to me fast. I'm busy over here.
They all heard the voice that returned.
We have a survivor on the south side, Colonel. Repeat. We have a survivor.
8. As the sun came up on the morning of October 28th, surviving was all the last member of the Dinsmore family could claim. Ollie lay with his body pressed against the bottom of the dome, gasping in just enough air from the big fans on the other side to stay alive. It had been a race just to get enough of the dome clear on his side before the remaining oxygen in the tank ran out. It was the one he'd left on the floor when he crawled under the potatoes. He remembered wondering if it would explode. It hadn't, and that was a very good thing for Oliver H. Dinsmore. If it had, he would now be lying dead under a burial mound of russets and long whites. He had knelt on his side of the dome, digging off cakes of black crud, aware that some of the stuff was all that remained of human beings. It was impossible to forget when he was being repeatedly stabbed by fragments of bone. Without Private Ames' steady encouragement, he was sure he would have given up. But Ames wouldn't give up. Just kept hectoring him to dig, goddammit, dig that shit clear, cow kid. You gotta do it so the fans can work. Ollie thought he hadn't given up because Ames didn't know his name. Ollie had lived with the kids at school calling him shit-kicker and tit-puller. But he was goddamn if he was going to die listening to some cracker from South Carolina call him Cow Kid. The fans had started up with a roar, and he had felt the first faint gusts of air on his overheated skin. He tore the mask off his face and pressed his mouth and nose directly against the dirty surface of the dome. Then, gasping and coughing out soot, he continued scraping at the plated char. He could see Ames on the other side, down on his hands and knees with his head cocked like a man trying to peer into a mouse hole.
That's it, he shouted. We got two more fans we're bringing up. Don't you give up on me, cow kid. Don't you quit.
Ollie, he had gasped.
What?
Name's Ollie. Stop calling me cow kid.
I'll call you Ollie from now until doomsday if you just keep clearing a space for those fans to work.
Ollie's lungs somehow managed to suck in just enough of what was seeping through the dome to keep him alive and conscious. He watched the world lighten through his slot in the soot. The light helped, too, although it hurt his heart to see the rose glow of dawn, dirtied by the film of filth that still remained on his side of the dome. The light was good, because in here everything was dark and scorched and hard and silent. They tried to relieve Ames of duty at 5 a.m., but Ollie screamed for him to stay, and Ames refused to leave. Whoever was in charge relented, little by little pausing to press his mouth to the dome and suck in more air. Ollie told how he had survived.
"I knew I'd have to wait for the fire to go out," he said, "so I took it real easy on the oxygen.
Grampy Tom told me once that one tank could last him all night if he was asleep, so I just laid there still. For quite a while, I didn't have to use it at all because there was air under the potatoes, and I breathed that." He put his lips to the surface, tasting the soot, knowing it might be the residue of a person who had been alive 24 hours previous, not caring. He sucked greedily and hacked out blackish crud until he could go on.
"It was cold under the potatoes at first, but then it got warm, and then it got hot. I thought I'd burn alive. The barn was burning down right over my head. Everything was burning. But it was so hot and so quick, it didn't last long, and maybe that was what saved me. I don't know. I stayed where I was until the first tank was empty. Then I had to go out. I was afraid the other one might have exploded, but it didn't. I bet it was close, though."
Ames nodded. Ollie sucked more air through the dome. It was like trying to breathe through a thick, dirty cloth.
"And the stairs. If they'd been wood instead of concrete block, I couldn't have gotten out. I didn't even try at first. I just crawled back under the spuds because it was so hot. The ones on the outside of the pile cooked in their jackets. I could smell them. Then it started to get hard to pull air. And I knew the second tank was running out, too."
He stopped as a coughing fit shook him. When it was under control, he went on.
"Mostly, I just wanted to hear a human voice again before I died. I'm glad it was you, Private Ames. My name's Clint, Ollie. And you're not going to die."
But the eyes that looked through the dirty slot at the bottom of the dome, like eyes peering through a glass window in a coffin, seemed to know some other, truer truth. 9. The second time the buzzer went off, Carter knew what it was, even though it awakened him from a dreamless sleep, because part of him wasn't going to really sleep again until this was over or he was dead. That was what the survival instinct was, he guessed. An unsleeping watchman deep in the brain. The second time was around 7:30 on Saturday morning. He knew that because his watch was the kind that lit up if you pressed a button. The emergency lights had died during the night and the fallout shelter was completely black. He sat up and felt something poke against the back of his neck. The barrel of the flashlight he'd used last night, he supposed. He fumbled for it and turned it on. He was on the floor. Big Jim was on the couch. It was Big Jim who had poked him with the flashlight. Of course he gets the couch, Carter thought resentfully. He's the boss, isn't he?
"Go on, son," Big Jim said. "Quick as you can."
Why does it have to be me, Carter thought, but did not say. It had to be him because the boss was old, the boss was fat, the boss had a bad heart. And because he was the boss, of course. James Rennie, the Emperor of Chester's Mill. Emperor of used cars, that's all you are, Carter thought. And you stink of sweat and sardine oil.
"Go on," sounding irritable and scared. "What are you waiting for?"
Carter stood up, the flashlight beam bouncing off the fallout shelter's packed shelves. So many cans of sardines. And made his way into the bunk room. One emergency light was still on in here, but it was guttering, almost out. The buzzer was louder now. A steady sound. The sound of oncoming doom. We're never getting out of here, Carter thought. He shone the flashlight beam on the trapdoor in front of the generator, which continued to utter the toneless, irritating buzz that for some reason made him think of the boss when the boss was speechifying. Maybe because both noises came down to the same stupid imperative. Feed me, feed me, feed me. Give me propane, give me sardines,
give me premium unleaded for my Hummer. Feed me. I'll still die, and then you'll die, but who cares? Who gives a ripe red fuck? Feed me. Feed me. Feed me. Inside the storage bin, there were now only 6 tanks of propane. When he replaced the one that was almost empty, there would be 5. 5 pissed little containers not much bigger than Blue Rhino tanks. Between them and choking to death when the air purifier quit. Carter pulled one out of the storage space, but he only set it beside the Jenny. He had no intention of replacing the current tank until it was totally empty, in spite of that irritating, nope, nope. Like they used to say about Maxwell House coffee, it was good to the last drop. But that buzzer could certainly get on a person's nerves. Carter reckoned he could find the alarm and silence it, but then how would they know when the Jenny was running dry? Like a couple of rats trapped in an overturned bucket, that's what we are. He ran the numbers in his head. 6 tanks left, each good for about 11 hours. But they could turn off the air conditioner, and that might stretch it to 12 or even 13 hours per tank. Stay on the safe side and say 12. 12 times 6 was, let's see. The made the math harder than it should have been, but he finally got there. 72 hours between them and a miserable, choking death down here in the dark. And why was it dark? Because no one had bothered to replace the batteries in the emergency lights, that was why. They probably hadn't been changed for 20 years or more. The boss had been saving money. And why only 7 little shit-licking tanks in the storage cubby where there had been about a zillion gallons out at WCIK, just waiting to blow up? Because the boss liked to have everything right where he wanted it. Sitting there, listening to the Carter remembered one of his dad's sayings, hoard a penny and lose a dollar. That was Rennie right down to the floor. Rennie, the emperor of used cars. Rennie, the big-shot politician. Rennie, the drug kingpin. How much had he made with his drug operation? $1 million? 2? And did it matter? He probably never would have spent it, Carter thought. And he's sure as shit not going to spend it now. Nothing to spend it on down here. He's got all the sardines he can eat. And they're free. Carter, Big Jim's voice came floating through the darkness. Are you going to change that out, or are we just going to listen to it buzz? Carter opened his mouth to holler they were going to wait, that every minute counted. But just then the finally quit. So did the queep, queep, queep of the air purifier. Carter, I'm on it, boss. With the flashlight clamped in his armpit, Carter pulled the empty, put the full one on a metal platform that was big enough to hold a tank 10 times this one's size, and hooked up the connector. Every minute counted. Or did it? Why did it, if it was going to come down to the same choking conclusion? But the survival watchman inside thought that was a bullshit question. The survival watchman thought 72 hours was 72 hours, and every minute of those 72 hours counted. Because who knew what might happen? The military guys might finally figure out how to crack the dome open. It might even disappear on its own, going as suddenly and inexplicably as it had come. Carter, what are you doing back there? My cotton-picking grandmother could move faster, and she's dead. Almost done. He made sure the connection was tight and put his thumb on the starter button, thinking that if the little generator's starter battery was as old as the batteries that had been powering the emergency lights, they were in trouble. Then he paused. It was 72 hours if it was the 2 of them. But if it was just him, he could stretch it to 90, or maybe even 100, by shutting down the purifier until the air got really thick. He had broached this idea to Big Jim, who had vetoed it out of hand. Got a dicky heart. He had reminded Carter. The thicker the air is, the more likely it is to play up on me. Carter! Loud and demanding. A voice that got up in his ears the way the smell of the boss's sardines got up his nose. What's going on back there? All set, boss, he called, and pushed the button. The starter motor whirred, and the Jenny fired up at once. I have to think about this, Carter told himself. But the survival watchman thought differently. The survival watchman thought that every minute lost was a minute wasted. He was good to me, Carter told himself. He gave me responsibilities.
dirty jobs he didn't want to do himself is what he gave you. And a hole in the ground to die in. That, too. Carter made up his mind. He pulled his Beretta from its holster as he walked back into the main room. He considered putting it behind his back, so the boss wouldn't know, and decided against it. The man had called him son, after all, and might even have meant it. He deserved better than an unexpected shot in the back of the head and going out all unprepared. 10. It wasn't dark at the far northeastern end of town. Here the dome was badly smudged, but far from opaque. The sun glared through and turned everything a feverish pink. Nori ran to Barbie and Julia. The girl was coughing and out of breath, but she ran anyway.
"My grandpa's having a heart attack," she wailed,
and then fell on her knees, hacking and gasping. Julia put her arms around the girl and turned her face to the roaring fans. Barbie crawled to where the exiles were surrounding Ernie Calvert, Rusty Everett, Ginny Tomlinson, and Dougie Twitchell. "Give them room, people," Barbie snapped. "Give the guy some air." "That's the problem," Tony Gay said. "They gave him what was left, the stuff that was supposed to be for the kids, but..."
"Epi," Rusty said, and Twitch handed him a syringe. Rusty injected it. "Ginny, start compressions. When you get tired, let Twitch take over, then me."
"I want to, too," Joni said.
Tears were streaming down her cheeks, but she seemed composed enough.
"I took a class."
"I was in it, too," Claire said. "I'll help."
"And me," Linda said quietly. "I took the refresher just last summer."
"It's a small town, and we all support the team," Barbie thought. Ginny, her face still swollen from her own injuries, began chest compressions. She gave way to Twitch, just as Julia and Nori joined Barbie.
"Will they be able to save him?" Nori asked.
"I don't know," Barbie said. But he did know. That was the hell of it. Twitch took over from Ginny. Barbie watched as drops of sweat from Twitch's forehead darkened Ernie's shirt. After about 5 minutes, he stopped, coughing breathlessly. When Rusty started to move in, Twitch shook his head.
"He's gone."
Twitch turned to Joni and said,
"I'm so sorry, Mrs. Calvert."
Joni's face trembled, then crumpled. She let out a cry of grief that turned into a coughing fit. Nori hugged her, coughing again herself.
"Barbie," a voice said. "A word."
It was Cox, now dressed in brown camo and wearing a fleece jacket against the chill on the other side. Barbie didn't like the somber expression on Cox's face. Julia went with him. They leaned close to the dome, trying to breathe slowly and evenly.
"There's been an accident at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico."
Cox kept his voice pitched low.
"They were running final tests on the pencil nuke we meant to try and... shit."
"It exploded?"
Julia asked, horrified.
"No, ma'am. Melted down. Two people were killed, and another half dozen are apt to die of radiation burns and or radiation poisoning. The point is we lost the nuke. We lost the fucking nuke."
"Was it a malfunction?" Barbie asked, almost hoping that it had been because that meant it wouldn't have worked anyway.
"No, Colonel, it did not. That's why I use the word accident. They happen when people hurry, and we've been hurrying our collective ass off."
"I'm so sorry for those men," Julia said. "Do their relatives know yet?"
"Given your own situation, it's very kind of you to think of that. They'll be informed soon. The accident occurred at 1 o'clock this morning. Work has already begun on Little Boy 2. It should be ready in 3 days, 4 at most."
Barbie nodded. "Thank you, sir. But I'm not sure we have that long." A long, thin wail of grief, a child's wail, went up from behind them. As Barbie and Julia turned around, the wail turned into a series of harsh coughs and gasps for air. They saw Linda kneel beside her elder daughter and fold the girl into her arms.
"She can't be dead,"
Janelle screamed.
"Audrey can't be dead."
But she was. The Everett's golden retriever had died in the night, quietly and without fuss, as the little Jays slept on either side of her. 11. When Carter came back into the main room, the Mills second selectman was eating cereal from a box with a cartoon parrot on the front. Carter recognized this mythical bird from many childhood breakfasts. Toucan Sam, the patron saint of Fruit Loops. "Must be stale as hell," Carter thought, and had a fleeting moment of pity for the boss. Then he thought of the difference between 70-some hours of air and 80 or 100, and hardened his heart. Big Jim scrummed more cereal from the box, then saw the Beretta in Carter's hand.
"Well," he said.
"I'm sorry, boss." Big Jim opened his hand and let the Fruit Loops cascade back into the box, but his hand was sticky, and some of the brightly colored cereal rings clung to his fingers and palms. Sweat gleamed on his forehead and trickled from his receding hairline.
"Son, don't do this." "I have to, Mr. Rennie. It's not personal."
Nor was it, Carter decided, not even a little bit. They were trapped in here, that was all. And because it had happened as a result of Big Jim's decisions, Big Jim would have to pay the price. Big Jim set the box of Fruit Loops on the floor. He did it with care, as if he were afraid the box might shatter if treated roughly.
"Then what is it?" "It just comes down to air. Air, I say. I could have come in here with the gun behind my back and just put a bullet in your head. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to give you time to get ready. Because you've been good to me."
"Then don't make me suffer, son." "If it's not personal, you won't make me suffer."
"If you keep still, you won't. It'll be quick. Like shooting a wounded deer in the woods."
"Can we talk about it?"
"No, sir. My mind is made up."
Big Jim nodded.
"All right, then. Can I have a word of prayer first? Would you allow me that?"
"Yes, sir. You can pray if you want, but make it fast. This is hard on me, too, you know."
"I believe it is. You're a good boy, son."
Carter, who hadn't cried since he was 14, felt a prickle in the corner of his eyes.
"Calling me son won't help you."
"It does help me, and seeing you're moved, that helps me, too."
Big Jim shuffled his bulk off the couch and got on his knees. In the act of doing this, he knocked over the Fruit Loops and uttered a sad little chuckle.
"Wasn't much of a last meal, I can tell you that."
"No, probably not. I'm sorry."
Big Jim, his back now to Carter's side.
"But I'll be eating roast beef at the Lord's table in a minute or two, so that's all right."
He raised a pudgy finger and pressed it high on the back of his neck.
"Right here. The brain stem. All right?"
Carter swallowed what felt like a large, dry ball of lint.
"Yes, sir."
"Do you want to get knee-bound with me, son?"
Carter, who had gone prayerless even longer than he'd gone tearless, almost, said yes. Then he remembered how sly the boss could be. He probably wasn't being sly now, was probably beyond that, but Carter had seen the man at work and was taking no chances. He shook his head.
"Say your prayer, and if you want to get all the way to Amen, you really have to make it a short one."
On his knees, back to Carter, Big Jim clasped his hands on the cushion of the sofa, which was still dimpled from the weight of his not inconsiderable fanny.
"Dear God, this is your servant. James Rennie, I guess I'm coming to you. Like it or not, the cup has been raised to my lips, and I can't..."
A large, dry sob escaped him.
"Turn out the light, Carter. I don't want to be crying in front of you. That's not how a man should die."
Carter extended the gun until it was almost touching the nape of Big Jim's neck.
"Okay. But that was your last request."
Then he turned out the light. He knew it was a mistake the instant he did it, but by then it was too late. He heard the boss move, and he was christing quick for a big man with a bad heart. Carter fired, and in the muzzle flash, he saw a bullet hole appear in the dented sofa cushion. Big Jim was no longer kneeling in front of it, but he couldn't have gone far, no matter how quick he was. As Carter thumbed the button of the flashlight, Big Jim drove forward with the butcher knife he had filched from the drawer next to the fallout shelter stove, and 6 inches of steel slid into Carter Thibodeau's stomach. He screamed in agony and fired again. Big Jim felt the bullet buzz close by his ear, but he didn't pull back. He also had a survival watchman, one that had served him extremely well over the years, and it was saying now that if he drew back, he would die. He staggered to his feet, pulling the knife upward as he rose, eviscerating the stupid boy who had thought he could get the best of Big Jim Rennie. Carter screamed again as he was split open. Beads of blood sprayed Big Jim's face, driven by what he devoutly hoped was the boy's last breath. He pushed Carter back, In the beam of the drop flashlight, Carter staggered away, crunching through spilled Fruit Loops and holding his belly. Blood poured over his fingers. He pawed at the shelves and fell to his knees in a rain of Vigo sardines, Snow's clam fryettes, and Campbell's soups. For a moment he stayed that way as if he had reconsidered and decided to say a prayer after all. His hair hung in his face, then he lost his grip and went down. Big Jim considered the knife, but that was too labor-intensive for a man suffering from heart problems. He promised himself again that he would get that taken care of as soon as this crisis was over. He picked up Carter's gun instead and walked to the foolish boy. "Carter, are you still with us?" Carter moaned, tried to turn over, gave up.
"I'm going to put one high up in the back of your neck, just as you suggested, but I want to give you one final piece of advice first. Are you listening?"
Carter groaned again. Big Jim took this for assent.
"The advice is this. Never give a good politician time to pray."
Big Jim pulled the trigger. 12.
"I think he's dying," Private Ames shouted. "I think the kid's dying."
Sergeant Groh knelt beside Ames and peered through the dirty slot at the bottom of the dome. Ollie Dinsmore was lying on his side with his lips almost pressed against a surface they could now see, thanks to the filth still clinging to it. In his best drill sergeant's voice, Groh yelled,
"Yo! Ollie Dinsmore, front and center!"
Slowly the boy opened his eyes and looked at the two men crouched less than a foot away, but in a colder, cleaner world. "What?" he whispered.
"Nothing, son," Groh said. "Go back to sleep."
Groh turned to Ames.
"Unbunch your panties, Private. He's fine."
"He's not. Just look at him."
Groh took Ames by the arm and helped him, not unkindly, to his feet.
"No," he agreed in a low voice. "He's not even slightly okay, but he's alive and sleeping, and right now, that's the best we can ask for. He'll use up less oxygen that way. You go get yourself something to eat. Did you get any breakfast?"
Ames shook his head. The thought of breakfast hadn't even crossed his mind.
"I won't stay in case he comes back round."
He paused, then plunged.
"I want to be here if he dies."
"He's not going to for a while," Groh said.
He had no idea if this was true or not. "Get something out of the truck. Even if it's only a slice of bologna wrapped in a slice of bread. You look like shit, soldier." Ames jerked his head toward the sleeping boy on charred ground with his mouth and nose cocked to the dome. His face was streaked with filth, and they could barely see the rise and fall of his chest.
"How long do you think he's got, Sarge?"
Groh shook his head.
"Probably not long. Someone in the group on the other side already died this morning, and several of the others aren't doing well. And it's better over there, cleaner. You have to prepare yourself."
Ames felt close to tears.
"Kid lost his whole family."
"Go get yourself something to eat. I'll watch until you come back."
"But after that, I can stay?"
"The kid wants you, Private. The kid gets you. You can stay until the end."
Groh watched Ames double time to the table near the helicopter where some food was laid out. Out here it was 10 o'clock on a pretty late fall morning. The sun was shining and melting off the last of a heavy frost. But only a few feet away there was a bubble world of perpetual twilight. A world where the air was unbreathable and time had ceased to have any meaning. Groh remembered a pond in the local park where he'd grown up, Wilton, Connecticut, that had been. There had been golden carp in the pond, big old things. The kids used to feed them. Until one day when one of the groundskeepers had an accident with some fertilizer, that was. Goodbye, fishies. All 10 or a dozen of them floating dead on the surface. Looking at the dirty, sleeping boy on the other side of the dome, it was impossible not to think of those carp. Only a boy was not a fish. Ames came back, eating something he obviously didn't want. Not much of a soldier, in Groh's opinion, but a good kid with a good heart. Private Ames sat down. Sergeant Groh sat with him. Around noon, they got a report from the north side of the dome that another of the survivors over there had died. A little boy named Aiden Appleton. Another kid. Groh believed he might have met his mother the day before. He hoped he was wrong about that, but didn't think he was.
"Who did it?" Ames asked him. "Who wound this shit up, Sergeant? Why?"
Gro shook his head.
No idea.
Makes no sense, Ames cried. Beyond them, Ollie stirred, lost his air, and moved his sleeping face once more to the scant breeze seeping through the barrier.
Don't wake him up, Gro said, thinking, if he goes in his sleep, it'll be better for all of us. 13. By 2 o'clock, all of the exiles were coughing except, incredible but true, Sam Verdreau, who seemed to be thriving in the bad air, and little Walter Bushy, who did nothing but sleep and suck the occasional ration of milk or juice. Barbie sat against the dome with his arm around Julia. Not far away, Thurston Marshall sat beside the covered corpse of little Aiden Appleton, who had died with terrifying suddenness. Thurst, now coughing steadily, was holding Alice on his lap. She had cried herself to sleep. 20 feet further on, Rusty was huddled with his wife and girls, who had also cried themselves to sleep. Rusty had taken Audrey's body to the ambulance, so the girls wouldn't have to look at it. He held his breath throughout. Even 15 yards inland from the dome, the air became choking, deadly. Once he got his wind back, he supposed he should do the same with the little boy. Audrey would be good company for him. She'd always liked kids. Joe McClatchy plopped down beside Barbie. Now he really did look like a scarecrow. His pale face was dotted with acne, and there were circles of bruised-looking purple flesh under his eyes.
My mom's sleeping, Joe said.
Julia, too, Barbie said, so keep your voice down. Julia opened one eye.
Not sleeping, she said, and promptly closed the eye again.
She coughed still, then coughed some more.
Benny's really sick, Joe said. He's running a fever, like the little boy did before he died.
He hesitated.
My mom's pretty warm, too. Maybe it's only because it's so hot in here, but I don't think that's it. What if she dies? What if we all do?
We won't, Barbie said. They'll figure something out. Joe shook his head.
They won't, and you know it, because they're outside. Nobody outside can help us.
He looked over the blackened wasteland where there had been a town the day before and laughed. A hoarse croaking sound that was worse because there was actually some amusement in it.
Chester's Mill has been a town since 1803. We learned that in school. Over 200 years. And a week to wipe it off the face of the earth. One fucking week is all it took. How about that, Colonel Barbara?
Barbie couldn't think of a thing to say. Joe covered his mouth, coughed. Behind them, the fans roared and roared.
I'm a smart kid, you know that. I mean, I'm not bragging, but I'm smart.
Barbie thought of the video feed the kid had set up near the site of the missile strike.
No argument, Joe. In a Spielberg movie, it's a smart kid who'd come up with the last-minute solution, isn't that right?
Barbie felt Julia stir again. Both eyes were open now, and she was regarding Joe gravely. Tears were trickling down the boy's cheeks.
Some Spielberg kid I turned out to be. If we were in Jurassic Park, the dinosaurs would eat us for sure.
If only they'd get tired, Julia said dreamily.
Huh?
Joe blinked at her.
The leatherhead children. Kids are supposed to get tired of their games and go on to something else, or...
She coughed hard.
Or their parents call them home for dinner.
Maybe they don't eat, Joe said gloomily. Maybe they don't have parents either.
Or maybe time is different for them, Barbie said. In their world, maybe they only just sat down around their version of the box. For them, the game might only be starting. We don't even know for sure they're children. Piper Libby joined them. She was flushed and her hair was sticking to her cheeks.
They're kids, she said.
How do you know? Barbie asked.
I just do. She smiled. They're the God I stopped believing in about 3 years ago. God turned out to be a bunch of bad little kids playing Interstellar Xbox. Isn't that funny?
Her smile widened and then she burst into tears. Julia was looking toward the box with its flashing purple light. Her face was thoughtful and a little dreamy. 14. It's Saturday night in Chester's Mill. That's the night the Eastern Star ladies used to meet.
and after the meeting they'd often go to Henrietta Clabbert's house and drink wine and break out their best dirty jokes. It's the night when Peter Randolph and his buddies used to play poker, and also break out their best dirty jokes. The night when Stuart and Fern Bowie often went to Lewiston to rent a couple of whores at a pussy parlor on Lower Lisbon Street. The night when the Reverend Lester Coggins used to hold teen prayer meetings in the parsonage hall at Holy Redeemer, and Piper Libby used to host teen dances in the basement of the Congo Church. The night when dippers used to roar until one, and around 12:30 the crowd would begin chanting drunkenly for their anthem, Dirty Water, a song all bands from Boston know well. The night when Howie and Brenda Perkins used to walk hand in hand on the town common, saying hello to the other couples they knew. The night when Alden Dinsmore, his wife, Shelley, and their two sons had been known to play catch by the light of a full moon. In Chester's Mill, as in most small towns where they all support the team, Saturday nights were usually the best nights, made for dancing and fucking and dreaming. Not this one. This one is black and seemingly endless. The wind has died. The poisoned air hangs hot and still. Out where Route 119 used to be until the furnace heat boiled it away, Ollie Dinsmore lies with his face pressed to his slot in the slag, still holding stubbornly onto life, and only a foot and a half away, Private Clint Ames continues his patient watch. Some bright boy wanted to shine a spotlight on the kid. Ames, supported by Sergeant Groh, not such an ogre after all, managed to keep it from happening, arguing that shining spotlights on sleeping people was what you did to terrorists, not teenage kids who would probably be dead before the sun rose. But Ames has a flashlight, and every now and then he shines it on the kid, making sure that he's still breathing. He is, but each time Ames uses the flashlight again, he expects it to show him that those shallow respirations have stopped. Part of him has actually started to hope for that. Part of him has started to accept the truth. No matter how resourceful Ollie Dinsmore has been or how heroically he's struggled, he has no future. Watching him fight on is terrible. Not long before midnight, Private Ames falls asleep himself, sitting up, with the flashlight clutched loosely in one hand. "Sleepest thou?" Jesus is said to have inquired of Peter. "Couldst thou not watch 1 hour?" To which Chef Bushy might have added, "Book of Matthew, Sanders." At just past 1 o'clock, Rose Twitchell shakes Barbie awake.
"Thurston Marshall is dead," she says. "Rusty and my brother are putting the body under the ambulance, so the little girl won't be too upset when she wakes up." Then she adds, "If she wakes up, Alice is sick, too." "We're all sick now," Julia says. "All except Sam and that dopey little baby."
Rusty and Twitch hurry back from the huddle of vehicles, collapse in front of one of the fans, and begin breathing in large, whooping gasps. Twitch starts coughing, and Rusty shoves him even closer to the air so hard that Twitch's forehead strikes the dome. They all hear the bonk. Rose has not quite finished her inventory.
"Benny Drake's bad, too."
She lowers her voice to a whisper.
"Ginny says he may not last until sunup. If only there was something we could do."
Barbie doesn't reply. Neither does Julia, who is once more looking in the direction of a box which, although less than 50 square inches in area and not even an inch thick, cannot be budged. Her eyes are distant, speculative. A reddish moon finally clears the accumulated filth on the eastern wall of the dome and shines down its bloody light. This is the end of October, and in Chester's Mill, October is the cruelest month, mixing memory with desire. There are no lilacs in this dead land. No lilacs, no trees, no grass. The moon looks down on ruination and little else.
15. Big Jim awoke in the dark, grabbing at his chest. His heart was misfiring again. He pounded at it. Then the alarm on the generator went off as the current tank of propane reached the danger point. "Feed me. Feed me." Big Jim jumped and cried out. His poor, tortured heart was lurching, missing, skipping, then running to catch up with itself. He felt like an old car with a bad carburetor. The kind of rattle trap you might take in trade, but would never sell. The kind that was good for nothing but the junk heap. He gasped and pounded. This was as bad as the one that had sent him to the hospital. Maybe even worse. The sound of some huge, gruesome insect. A cicada, maybe. Here in the dark with him. Who knew what might have crept in here while he was sleeping? Big Jim fumbled for the flashlight. With the other hand, he alternately pounded and rubbed, telling his heart to settle down, not to be such a cotton-picking baby. He hadn't gone through all of this just to die in the dark. He found the flashlight, struggled to his feet, and stumbled over the body of his late aide-de-camp. He cried out again and went to his knees. The flashlight didn't break, but went rolling away from him, casting a moving spotlight on the lowest left-hand shelf, which was stacked with boxes of spaghetti and cans of tomato paste. Big Jim crawled after it. As he did, Carter Thibodeau's open eyes moved. Carter? Sweat was running down Big Jim's face. His cheeks felt coated with some light, stinking grease. He could feel his shirt sticking to him. His heart took another of those looping larrups, and then, for a wonder, settled into its normal rhythm again. Well, no, not exactly. But at least into something more like a normal rhythm.
Carter? Son? Are you alive?
Ridiculous, of course. Big Jim had gutted him like a fish on a riverbank, then shot him in the back of the head. He was as dead as Adolf Hitler. Yet he could have sworn, well, almost sworn, that the boy's eyes... He fought back the idea that Carter was going to reach out and seize him by the throat, telling himself it was normal to feel a little bit terrified, nervous, because the boy had nearly killed him, after all, and still expecting Carter to sit up and draw him forward and bury hungry teeth in his throat. Big Jim pressed his fingers under Carter's jaw. The blood-sticky flesh was cold, and no pulse moved there. Of course not. The kid was dead, had been dead for 12 hours or more.
"You're eating dinner with your savior, son,"
Big Jim whispered. "Roast beef and mashed. Apple cobbler for dessert." This made him feel better. He crawled after the flashlight, and when he thought he heard something move behind him, the whisper of a hand, perhaps, slipping across the concrete floor, blindly questing, he didn't look back. He had to feed the generator, had to silence the... While he was pulling one of the four remaining tanks out of the storage cubby, his heart went into arrhythmia again. He sat beside the open trap door, gasping and trying to cough his heart back into a regular rhythm, and praying, unaware that his prayer was basically a series of demands and rationalizations. Make it stop. None of it was my fault. Get me out of here. I did the best I could. Put everything back the way it was. I was let down by incompetence. Heal my heart. For Jesus' sake, amen, he said. But the sound of the words chilled rather than comforted. They were like bones rattling in a tomb. By the time his heart had settled a little, the hoarse, cicada cry of the alarm had stilled. The current tank had run dry. Save for the glow of the flashlight, it was now as dark in the fallout shelter's second room as in the first. The remaining emergency light in here had flickered its last 7 hours ago. Struggling to remove the empty tank and get the fresh one onto the platform beside the generator, Big Jim had a faint memory of stamping "no action" on a shelter maintenance requisition that had come across his desk a year or two ago. That requisition had probably included the price of fresh batteries for the emergency lights, but he couldn't blame himself. There was only so much money in a town budget, and people always had their hands out. Feed me, feed me. Al Timmons should have done it on his own initiative, he told himself. For God's sake, is a little initiative too much to ask? Isn't that part of what we pay the maintenance staff for? He could have gone to that frog burpee and asked for them as a donation, for heaven's sake. That's what I would have done. He connected the tank to the generator. Then his heart stuttered again. His hand jerked, and he knocked the flashlight into the storage bin, where it clanged against one of the remaining tanks. The lens shattered, and he was left once more in total darkness.
No! He screamed. No, goddammit, no!
But from God, there was no answer. The quiet and the dark pressed in on him as his overstrained heart choked and struggled. Traitorous thing.
Never mind, there'll be another flashlight in the other room. Matches, too. I'll just have to find them. If Carter had stockpiled them to begin with, I could go right to them. It was true. He had overestimated that boy. He had thought the kid was a comer, but in the end he had turned out to be a goer. Big Jim laughed, then made himself stop. The sound in such total darkness was a little spooky. Never mind. Start the generator.
Yes.
Right. The generator was job one. He could double-check the connection once it was running and the air purifier was creeping away again. By then he'd have another flashlight, maybe even a Coleman lantern. Plenty of light for the next tank switchover.
That's the ticket, he said. If you want something done right in this world, you have to do it yourself. Just ask Coggins. Just ask the Perkins Rhymes with Witch. They know.
He laughed some more. He couldn't help it, because it really was rich.
They found out. You don't tease a big dog if you only have a little stick. No, sir. No, siree.
He felt around for the starter button, found it, pushed it. Nothing happened. Suddenly the air in the room seemed thicker than ever. I pushed the wrong button, that's all. Knowing better, but believing it because some things have to be believed. He blew on his fingers like a crap shooter hoping to heat up a cold pair of dice. Then he felt around until his fingers found the button.
God, he said, this is your servant, James Rennie. Please let this darn old thing start. I ask it in the name of your son, Jesus Christ.
He pushed the starter button. Nothing. He sat in the dark with his feet dangling in the storage compartment, trying to push back the panic that wanted to descend and eat him raw. He had to think. It was the only way to survive. But it was hard. When you were in the dark, when your heart was threatening full revolt at any second, thinking was hard. And the worst of it? Everything he'd done and everything he'd worked for during the last 30 years of his life seemed unreal. Like the way people looked on the other side of the dome. They walked, they talked, they drove cars, they even flew in airplanes and helicopters. But none of it mattered. Not under the dome. Get hold of yourself. If God won't help you, help yourself. Okay. The first thing was light. Even a book of matches would do. There had to be something on one of the shelves in the other room. He would just feel along, very slowly, very methodically, until he found it. And then he would find batteries for the cotton-picking starter motor. There were batteries, of that he was sure, because he needed the generator. Without the generator, he would die.
Suppose you do get it started again, what happens when the propane runs out?
Ah, but something would intervene. He wasn't meant to die down here. Roast beef with Jesus? He'd pass on that meal, actually. If he couldn't sit at the head of the table, he'd just as soon skip the whole thing. That made him laugh again. He made his way very slowly and carefully back to the door leading into the main room. He held his hands out in front of him like a blind man. After 7 steps, they touched the wall. He moved to the right, trailing his fingertips over the wood, and, ah, emptiness. The doorway. Good. He shuffled through it, moving more confidently now in spite of the blackness. He remembered the layout of this room perfectly. Shelves to either side, couch dead ahead. He tripped over the goddamn cotton-picking kid again and went sprawling. He hit his forehead on the floor and screamed, more in surprise and outrage than in pain, because there was a carpet to pad the blow. But, oh, God, there was a dead hand between his legs. It seemed to be clutching at his balls. Big Jim got to his knees, crawled forward, and hit his head again, this time on the couch. He let out another yell, then crawled up onto it, pulling his legs after him quickly, the way a man might pull his legs from water he's just realized is infested with sharks. He lay there trembling, telling himself to calm down. He had to calm down, or he really would have a heart attack. When you feel those arrhythmias, you need to center yourself and take long, deep breaths, the hippie doctor had told him. At the time, Big Jim had considered this New Age bullshit, but now there was nothing else. He didn't have his verapamil, so he'd have to try it. And it seemed to work. After 20 deep breaths and long, slow exhales, he could feel his heart settling. The coppery taste was leaving his mouth. Unfortunately, a weight seemed to be settling on his chest. Pain was creeping down his left arm. He knew these were heart attack symptoms.
but he thought indigestion from all the sardines he'd eaten was just as likely, more likely. The long, slow breaths were taking care of his heart just fine, but he would still get it looked at when he was out of this mess, maybe even give in and get that bypass surgery. The heat was the problem. The heat and the thick air. He had to find that flashlight and get the Jenny going again, just one more minute, or maybe two. Someone was breathing in here. Yes, of course, I'm breathing in here. And yet, he was quite sure he heard someone else. More than just one someone. It seemed to him that there were several people in here with him, and he thought he knew who they were. That's ridiculous. Yes, but one of the breathers was behind the couch. One was lurking in the corner, and one was standing not 3 feet in front of him. No, stop it. Brenda Perkins behind the couch, Lester Coggins in the corner, his jaw unhinged and hanging, and standing dead ahead. No, Big Jim said, that's crap, that's bullshit. He closed his eyes and tried to concentrate on taking those long, slow breaths. It sure smells good in here, Dad, Junior droned from in front of him. It smells like the pantry and my girlfriend's. Big Jim shrieked.
Help me up, bro, Carter said from where he lay on the floor. He cut me up pretty bad. Shot me, too.
Stop it, Big Jim whispered. I don't hear any of that, so just stop it. I'm counting breaths. I'm settling my heart.
I still have the papers, Brenda Perkins said, and lots of copies. Soon they'll be tacked to every telephone pole in town, the way Julia tacked up the last issue of a newspaper. Be sure your sin will find you out. Numbers chapter 32.
You're not there.
But then, something, it felt like a finger, kissed its way down his cheek.
Big Jim shrieked again. The fallout shelter was full of dead people who were nevertheless breathing the increasingly foul air, and they were moving in. Even in the dark, he could see their pale faces. He could see his dead son's eyes. Big Jim bolted up from the couch, flailing at the black air with his fists.
Get away! All of you, get away from me!
He charged for the stairs and tripped over the bottom one. This time there was no carpet to cushion the blow. Blood began to drip into his eyes. A dead hand caressed the back of his neck.
You killed me,
Lester Coggins said. But with his broken jaw, it came out, ooh-ee. Big Jim ran up the stairs and hit the door at the top with all his considerable weight. It squalled open, pushing charred lumber and fallen bricks in front of it. It went just far enough for him to squeeze through.
No, he barked. No, don't touch me. None of you, touch me.
It was almost as dark in the ruins of the town hall conference room as in the shelter, but with one big difference. The air was worthless. Big Jim realized this when he pulled in his third breath. His heart, tortured beyond endurance by this final outrage, once more rose into his throat. This time, it stuck there. Big Jim suddenly felt as if he were being crushed from throat to navel by a terrible weight, a long burlap sack filled with stones. He struggled back to the door like a man moving through mud. He tried to squeeze through the gap, but this time he stuck fast. A terrible sound began to emerge from his gaping mouth and closing throat, and the sound was, ah, feed me, feed me, feed me. He flailed once again, then once more, a hand reaching out, grasping for some final rescue. It was caressed from the other side.
Daddy,
a voice crooned. 16. Someone shook Barbie awake just before dawn on Sunday morning. He came to reluctantly, coughing, turning instinctively to the dome and the fans beyond. When the coughing finally eased, he looked to see who had awakened him. It was Julia. Her hair hung lankly, and her cheeks were blooming with fever, but her eyes were clear. She said, "Benny Drake died an hour ago." "Oh, Julia, Jesus, I'm sorry." His voice was cracked and hoarse, not his own voice at all. "I have to get to the box that's making the dome," she said. "How do I get to the box?" Barbie shook his head. "It's impossible. Even if you could do something to it, it's on the ridge, almost half a mile from here.
We can't even go to the vans without holding our breaths, and they're only 50 feet away.
There's a way, someone said.
They looked around and saw Sloppy Sam Verdreau. He was smoking the last of his cigarettes and looking at them with sober eyes. He was sober, entirely sober, for the first time in 8 years. He repeated,
There's a way. I can show you.
Wear it home, it'll look like a dress. 1. It was 7:30 a.m. They had all gathered round, even the late Benny Drake's wretched, red-eyed mother. Alva had her arm around Alice Appleton's shoulders. All that little girl's former sass and spunk was gone now, and as she breathed, rails rattled in her narrow chest. When Sam finished what he had to say, there was a moment of silence, except, of course, for the omnipresent roar of the fans. Then Rusty said,
It's crazy. You'll die.
If we stay here, will we live? Barbie asked.
Why would you even try to do such a thing? Linda asked. Even if Sam's idea works and you make it.
Oh, I think it'll work, Romy said.
Sure it will, Sam said. Guy named Peter Bergeron told me not long after the big Bar Harbor fire back in 47. Pete was a lot of things, but never a liar.
Even if it does, Linda said, why? Because there's one thing we haven't tried, Julia said.
Now that her mind was made up and Barbie had said he would go with her, she was composed.
We haven't tried begging.
You're crazy, Jules, Tony Gay said. Do you think they'll even hear or listen if they do? Julia turned her grave face to Rusty.
That time your friend George Lathrop was burning ants alive with his magnifying glass, did you hear them beg?
Ants can't beg, Julia.
You said it occurred to me that ants also have their little lives. Why did it occur to you?
Because... He trailed off, then shrugged.
Maybe you did hear them, Lissa Jameson said.
With all due respect, that's bullshit, Pete Freeman said. Ants are ants, they can't beg.
But people can, Julia said. And do we not also have our little lives?
To this no one replied.
What else is there to try?
From behind them, Colonel Cox spoke up. They had all but forgotten him. The outside world and its denizens seemed irrelevant now.
I'd try it. In your shoes. Don't quote me, but... Yes, I would. Barbie?
I've already agreed, Barbie said. She's right. There's nothing else. 2.
Let's see them sacks, Sam said.
Linda handed over 3 green hefty bags. In 2 of them she had packed clothes for herself and Rusty and a few books for the girls. The shirts, pants, socks, and underwear now lay carelessly discarded behind the little group of survivors. Romy had donated the 3rd, which he'd used to carry 2 deer rifles. Sam examined all 3, found a hole in the bag that had held the guns, and tossed it aside. The other 2 were intact.
All right, he said, listen close. It should be Mrs. Everett's van that goes out to the box. But we need it over here first.
He pointed to the Odyssey.
You sure about the windows being rolled up, missus? You gotta be sure, because lives are gonna depend on it.
They were rolled up, Linda said. We were using the air conditioner.
Sam looked at Rusty.
You're gonna drive it over here, Doc, but the first thing you do is turn off the factory air. You understand why, right?
To protect the environment inside the cabin.
Some of the bad air will get in when you open the door, sure, but not much if you're quick. There'll be good air inside still, town air. The folks inside can breathe easy all the way to the box. That old van's no good.
And not just because the windows are open.
We had to,
Nori said, looking at the stolen phone company van.
The air conditioning was busted, Grampy said.
A tear rolled slowly out of her left eye and cut through the dirt on her cheek. There was dirt everywhere now, and soot, almost too fine to see, sifting down from the murky sky.
That's fine, honey, Sam told her. The tires ain't worth a tin shit anyway. One look and you know whose used car lot that pup came from.
Guess that means my van if we need another vehicle, Romy said. I'll get it.
But Sam was shaking his head. It better be Mrs. Shumway's car on account of the tires are smaller and easier to handle. Also, they're brand new. The air inside them will be fresher.
Joe McClatchy broke into a sudden grin.
The air from the tires? Put the air from the tires in the garbage bags? Homemade scuba tanks? Mr. Verdreau, that is genius.
Sloppy Sam grinned himself, showing all six of his remaining teeth.
Can't take the credit, son. Pete Bergeron gets the credit. He told about a couple of men got trapped behind that fire in Bar Harbor after it went and crowned. They were okay, but the air wasn't fit to breathe, so what they did was bust the cap off a pulp truck tire and took turns breathing right from the stem until the wind cleared the air. Pete said they told him it was nasty tasting, like old dead fish. But it kept him alive.
Will one tire be enough? Julia asked.
Might be, but we dasn't trust the spare if it's one of those little emergency donuts built to get you 20 miles down the highway and no more.
It's not, Julia said. I hate those things. I asked Johnny Carver to get me a new one, and he did.
She looked toward town.
I suppose Johnny's dead now. Carrie, too.
We better take one off the car as well, just to be safe, Barbie said.
You've got your jack, right?
Julia nodded. Romy Burpee grinned without much humor.
I'll race you back here, Doc. Your van against Julia's hybrid.
I'll drive the Prius over, Piper said. You stay where you are, Romy. You look like shit.
Nice talk from a minister, Romy grumbled.
You ought to be thankful I still feel lively enough to talk some trash.
In truth, Reverend Libby looked far from lively, but Julia handed over her keys anyway. None of them looked ready to go out drinking and juking, and Piper was in better shape than some. Claire McClatchy was as pale as milk.
Okay, Sam said. We got one other little problem, but first...
What? Linda asked. What other problem?
Don't worry about that now. First, let's get our rolling iron over here. When do you want to try it?
Rusty looked at the Mills Congregational Minister. Piper nodded. No time like the present, Rusty said. 3. The remaining townies watched, but not alone. Cox and almost 100 other soldiers had gathered on their side of the dome, looking on with the silent attention of spectators at a tennis match. Rusty and Piper hyperventilated at the dome, loading their lungs with as much oxygen as possible. Then they ran hand in hand toward the vehicles. When they got there, they separated. Piper stumbled to one knee, dropping the Prius keys, and all the watchers groaned. Then she snatched them from the grass and was up again. Rusty was already in the Odyssey van with the motor running as she opened the door of the little green car and flung herself inside.
Hope they remembered to turn off the air conditioning, Sam said.
The vehicles turned in almost perfect tandem, the Prius shadowing the much larger van like a terrier herding a sheep. They drove quickly to the dome, bouncing over the rough road. The exiles scattered before them, Alva carrying Alice Appleton and Linda with a coughing little Jay under each arm. The Prius stopped less than a foot away from the dirty barrier, but Rusty swung the Odyssey around and backed it in.
Your husband's got a good set of balls on him and an even better set of lungs, Sam told Linda matter-of-factly.
It's because he gave up smoking, Linda said, and either did not hear Twitch's strangled snort, or affected not to. Good lungs or not, Rusty didn't linger. He slammed the door behind him and hustled to the dome.
Piece of cake, he said,
and began to cough. Is the air inside the van breathable, like Sam said?
Better than what's here.
He laughed distractedly, but he's right about something else. Every time the doors open, a little more good air gets out and a little more bad air gets in. You probably can get out to the box without tire air, but I don't know if you can get back without it.
They ain't gonna be driving, neither one of them, Sam said. I'm gonna drive.
Barbie felt his lips turn up in the first genuine grin to grace his face in days.
Thought you lost your license. Don't see any cops out here, Sam said. He turned to Cox. What about you, Cap? See any local yokels or county mounties?
Not a one, Cox said.
Julia drew Barbie aside.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Yes.
You know the chances hover somewhere between slim and none, right?
Yes.
How are you at begging, Colonel Barbara? He flashed back to the gym in Fallujah. Emerson kicking one prisoner's balls so hard they flew up in front of him. Hackermeyer pulling another one up by his hijab, then putting a gun to his head. The blood had hit the wall like it always hits the wall. Right back to the time when men fought with clubs.
I don't know, he said. All I know is, it's my turn.
4. Romy, Pete Freeman, and Tony Gay jacked up the Prius and pulled off one of the working tires. It was a small car, and under ordinary circumstances, they might have been able to lift the rear end with their bare hands. Not now. Although the car was parked close to the fans, they had to run back to the dome repeatedly for air before the job was done. In the end, Rose took over for Tony, who was coughing too hard to continue. Finally, though, they had two new tires leaning against the dome.
So far, so good, Sam said. Now for that other little problem. I hope somebody's got an idea, because I sure don't.
They looked at him.
My friend Peter said those guys busted off the valve and breathed direct from the tire. But that ain't gonna work here. You gotta fill up those garbage bags. And that means a bigger hole. You can punch into the tires, but without something to stick in the hole, something like a straw, you're gonna lose more air than you catch. So, what's it gonna be?
He looked around hopefully.
Nobody brought a tent, I don't suppose. One of them, what, the hollow aluminum poles?
The girls have a play tent, Linda said, but it's back home in the garage.
Then she remembered that the garage was gone, along with the house it was attached to, and laughed wildly.
How about the barrel of a pen? Joe asked. I've got a Bic.
Not big enough, Barbie said. Rusty, what about the ambulance?
A trach tube?
Rusty asked doubtfully, then answered his own question.
No. Still not big enough.
Barbie turned.
Colonel Cox, any ideas?
Cox shook his head reluctantly. We've probably got 1,000 things over here that would work, but that doesn't help much.
We can't let this stop us, Julia said. Barbie heard frustration and a raw edge of panic in her voice. Never mind the bags, we'll take the tires and breathe directly from them.
Sam was already shaking his head.
Not good enough, missus, sorry, but it's not.
Linda, bent close to the dome, took several deep breaths, held the last. Then she went to the back of her Odyssey van, rubbed some of the soot from the back window, and peered in.
The bag's still there, she said. Thank God.
What bag? Rusty asked, taking her by the shoulders.
The one from Best Buy, with your birthday present in it. November 8th. Or did you forget?
I did, on purpose. Who the hell wants to turn 40? What is it?
I knew if I brought it in the house before I was ready to wrap it, you'd find it.
She looked at the others, her face solemn and as dirty as a street urchin's.
He's a nosy old thing. So I left it in the van. What did you get him, Lenny?
Jackie Weddington asked.
I hope a present for all of us, Linda said.
5. When they were ready, Barbie, Julia, and Sloppy Sam hugged and kissed everybody, even the kids. There was little hope in the faces of the nearly 24 exiles who would remain behind. Barbie tried to tell himself it was just because they were exhausted, and now chronically short of breath, but he knew better. These were goodbye kisses.
Good luck, Colonel Barbara,
Cox said. Barbie gave him a brief nod of acknowledgement, then turned to Rusty. Rusty, who really mattered, because he was under the dome.
Don't give up hope. And don't let them give up hope. If this doesn't work, take care of them as long as you can. And as well as you can.
I hear you. Give it your best shot. Barbie tilted his head toward Julia. It's mostly her shot, I think. And hell, maybe we'll make it back even if it doesn't work.
Sure you will, Rusty said.
He sounded hearty, but what he believed was in his eyes. Barbie slapped him on the shoulder, then joined Sam and Julia at the dome, once more taking deep breaths of the fresh air that came trickling through. To Sam, he said, Are you sure you really want to do this?
Oh, yeah. I got something to make up for.
What would that be, Sam? Julia asked.
I'd rather not say.
He smiled a little.
Especially not to the town newspaper lady.
You ready? Barbie asked Julia.
Yes.
She grabbed his hand, gave it one brief, hard squeeze.
As much as I can be.
6. Romy and Jackie Weddington stationed themselves at the rear doors of the van. When Barbie shouted, "Go!" Jackie opened the door gate and Romy threw the two Prius tires inside. Barbie and Julia hurled themselves in directly after, and the doors were slammed behind them a split second later. Sam Verdreau, old and booze-rattled but still spry as a cricket, was already behind the Odyssey's wheel and revving the engine. The air inside the van stank of what was now the outside world, an aroma that was charred wood on top and a painty, turpentiny stench beneath. But it was still better than what they had been breathing at the dome, even with dozens of fans blasting.
Won't be better for long, Barbie thought. Not with three of us sucking it up.
Julia grabbed the distinctive yellow and black Best Buy sack and turned it over. What fell out was a plastic cylinder with the words "Perfect Echo" on it, and beneath that, 50 recordable CDs. She began to pick at the sealed cellophane overwrap with no immediate success. Barbie reached for his pocket knife, and his heart sank. The knife wasn't there, of course not. It was now just a hunk of slag under whatever remained of the PD.
Sam, please tell me you have a pocket knife.
Without a word, Sam tossed one back. That was my dad's. I've been carrying it my whole life, and I want it back. The knife's sides were wood inlay rubbed almost smooth with age, but when he opened it, the single blade was sharp. It would work on the overwrap, and it would make nice, neat punctures in the tires.
Hurry up, Sam yelled, and revved the Odyssey's engine harder. We ain't going till you tell me you got the right thing, and I doubt the engine'll run forever in this air.
Barbie slit the overwrap. Julia stripped it away. When she rotated the plastic cylinder half a turn to the left, it came off the base. The blank CDs that had been meant for Rusty Everett's birthday sat on a black plastic spindle. She dumped the CDs on the floor of the van, then closed her fist around the spindle. Her mouth tightened with effort.
Let me do that, he said.
But then she snapped it off.
Girls are strong, too, especially when they're scared to death.
Is it hollow? If it isn't, we're back to square one.
She held the spindle up to her face. Barbie looked down one end and saw her blue eye staring back from the other.
Go, Sam, he said. We're in business.
You're sure to work,
Sam shouted back, dropping the van's transmission into drive.
You bet,
Barbie returned, because how the hell should I know would cheer nobody up, including himself. 7. The survivors at the dome watched silently as the van tore down the dirt track that led back to what Nori Calvert had taken to calling the Flashbox. The Odyssey dimmed into the hanging smog, became a phantom, and then disappeared. Rusty and Linda were standing together, each carrying a child.
What do you think, Rusty?
Linda asked.
He said, I think we need to hope for the best.
And prepare for the worst?
That too, he said.
8. They were passing the farmhouse when Sam called back.
We're going into the orchard now. You want to hold on to your jockstraps, kiddies, because I ain't stopping this bitch even if I rip the undercarriage right out in it.
Go for it, Barbie said, and then a vicious bump tossed him in the air with his arms wrapped around one of the spare tires. Julia was clutching the other one like a shipwreck victim clutching a life ring. Apple trees flashed by. The leaves looked dirty and dispirited. Most of the fruit had fallen to the ground, shaken free by the wind that had sucked through the orchard after the explosion. Another tremendous bump. Barbie and Julia went up and came down together, Julia sprawling across Barbie's lap and still holding onto her tire.
Where'd you get your license, you old fuck? Barbie shouted. Sears and Roebuck? Walmart,
the old man shouted back.
Everything's cheaper at Wally World.
Then he stopped cackling.
I see it. I see the blinky-ass whoremaster. Bright purple light. Gonna pull right up beside it. You wait until I stop before you go carving on those tires, lest you want to tear 'em wide open.
A moment later, he stamped on the brake and brought the Odyssey to a scrunching halt that sent Barbie and Julia sliding into the back of the rear seat. Now I know what a pinball feels like, Barbie thought.
You drive like a Boston cabbie, Julia said indignantly. You just make sure you tip.
Sam was stopped by a hard fit of coughing.
20%.
His voice sounded choked.
Sam?
Julia asked.
Are you all right?
Maybe not, he said matter-of-factly. I'm bleeding somewhere. Could be throat, but it feels deeper. Believe I might have ruptured a lung.
Then he was coughing again.
What can we do? Julia asked.
Sam got the coughing under control.
Make them shut off their fucking jammer so we can get out of here. I got no more smokes.
9. This is all me, Julia said. Just so you know that. Barbie nodded.
Yes'm?
You're strictly my air boy. If what I try doesn't work, we can change jobs. It might help if I knew exactly what you had in mind. There's nothing exact about it. All I have is intuition and a little hope. Don't be such a pessimist. You've also got 2 tires, 2 garbage bags, and a hollow spindle. She smiled. It lit up her tense, dirty face.
Duly noted.
Sam was coughing again, doubled over the wheel. He spat something out.
Dear God and sunny Jesus, don't that taste nasty, he said. Hurry up.
Barbie punctured his tire with the knife and heard the whoosh of air as soon as he pulled the blade free. Julia slapped the spindle into his hand as efficiently as an OR nurse. Barbie jammed it into the hole, saw the rubber grip it, and then felt a divine rush of air spurt into his sweaty face. He breathed deeply once, unable to help himself. The air was much fresher, much richer than that pushed through the dome by the fans. His brain seemed to wake up, and he came to an immediate decision. Instead of putting a garbage bag over their makeshift nozzle, he tore a large, ragged swatch from one of them.
"What are you doing?" Julia screamed.
There was no time to tell her she wasn't the only one with intuitions. He plugged the spindle with the plastic. "Trust me. Just go to the box and do what you have to do." She gave him a final look that seemed to be all eyes, then opened the Odyssey's door gate. She half fell to the ground, picked herself up, stumbled over a hummock, and went to her knees beside the flashbox. Barbie followed her with both tires. He had Sam's knife in his pocket. He fell on his knees and offered Julia the tire with the black spindle sticking out of it. She yanked the plug, breathed in, her cheeks hollowing with the effort, exhaled to one side, then breathed in again. Tears were rolling down her cheeks, cutting clean places there. Barbie was crying, too. It had nothing to do with emotion. It was as if they had been caught out in the world's nastiest acid rain. This was far worse than the air at the dome. Julia sucked in more.
Good,
she said, speaking on the exhale and almost whistling the word.
So good. Not fishy. Dusty.
She breathed in again, then tilted the tire toward him. He shook his head and pushed it back, although his lungs were beginning to pound. He patted his chest, then pointed at her. She took another deep breath, then sucked in one more. Barbie pushed down on top of the tire to help her along. Faintly, in some other world, he could hear Sam coughing and coughing and coughing. He'll rip himself apart, Barbie thought. He felt as if he might come apart himself if he didn't breathe soon, and when Julia pushed the tire at him a second time, he bent over the makeshift straw and sucked in deeply, trying to draw the dusty, wonderful air all the way to the bottom of his lungs. There wasn't enough. It seemed there could never be enough. And there was a moment when panic, God, I'm drowning, almost engulfed him. The urge to bolt back to the van, never mind Julia, let Julia take care of herself, was nearly too strong to resist. But he did resist it. He closed his eyes, breathed, and tried to find the cool, calm center that had to be there someplace. Easy. Slow. Easy. He dragged in a third long, steady inhale from the tire, and his pounding heart began to slow a little. He watched Julia lean forward and grip the box on either side. Nothing happened, and this didn't surprise Barbie. She had touched the box when they first came up here, and was now immune to the shock. Then, suddenly, her back arched. She moaned. Barbie tried to offer her the spindle straw, but she ignored it. Blood burst from her nose and began to trickle from the corner of her right eye. Red drops slid down her cheek.
"What's happening?"
Sam called. His voice was muffled, choked. "I don't know," Barbie thought. "I don't know what's happening." But he knew one thing. If she didn't take more air soon, she'd die.
He pulled the spindle out of the tire, clamped it between his teeth, and plunged Sam's knife into the second tire. He drove the spindle into the hole and plugged it with the swatch of plastic. Then he waited. 10. This is the time that is no time. She's in a vast, white, roofless room with an alien green sky above. It's... what? The playroom? Yes, the playroom. Their playroom. No. She's lying on the floor of the bandstand. She's a woman of a certain age. No. She's a little girl. There is no time. It's 1974, and there's all the time in the world. She needs to breathe from the tire. She doesn't. Something is looking at her, something terrible. But she is terrible to it as well, because she's bigger than she's supposed to be, and she's here. She's not supposed to be here. She's supposed to be in the box. Yet she is still harmless. It knows that, even though it is just a kid. Very young. Barely out of the nursery, in fact. It speaks. You are make-believe. No. I'm real. Please. I'm real. We all are. The leatherhead regards her with its eyeless face. It frowns, the corners of its mouth turned down, although it has no mouth, and Julia realizes how lucky she is to have found one of them alone. There are usually more, but they have gone home to dinner, gone home to lunch, gone to bed, gone to school, gone on vacation. Doesn't matter, they're gone. Gone somewhere. If they were here together, they would drive her back. This one could drive her back alone, but she is curious. She? Yes. This one is female, like her. Please, let us go. Please, let us live our little lives. No answer, no answer, no answer. Then, you aren't real. You are what? What does she say? You are toys from the toy shop? No, but it's something like that. Julia has a flicker memory of the ant farm her brother had when they were kids. The recollection comes and goes in less than a second. Ant farm isn't right either, but like toys from the toy shop, it's close. It's in the ballpark, as they say. How can you have lives if you aren't real? We are so real, she cries. And this is the moan Barbie hears. As real as you. Silence. A thing with a shifting leather face in a vast, white, roofless room that is also somehow the Chester's Mill bandstand. Then, prove it. Give me your hand. I have no hand. I have no body. Bodies aren't real. Bodies are dreams. Then give me your mind. The leatherhead child does not. Will not. So Julia takes it. 11. This is the place that is no place. It's cold on the bandstand and she's so scared. Worse, she's humiliated? No, it's much worse than humiliation. If she knew the word abased, she would say, yes, yes, that's it, I'm abased. They took her slacks. And somewhere soldiers are kicking naked people in a gym. This is someone else's shame all mixed up with hers. She's crying. He feels like crying but doesn't. Right now they have to cover this up. The girls have left her now, but her nose is still bleeding. Lila slapped her and promised to cut her nose off if she told, and they all spit on her. And now she is lying here, and she must have cried really hard because she thinks her eye is bleeding as well as her nose, and she can't seem to catch her breath. But she doesn't care how much she bleeds, or from where. She'd rather bleed to death on the bandstand floor than walk home in her stupid baby underpants. She'd gladly bleed to death from 100 places, if it meant she didn't have to see the soldier. After this, Barbie tries not to think of that soldier. But when he does, he thinks, Hackermeyer the hacker monster. Pull the naked man up by the thing, Hajib. He's wearing on his head because she knows what comes next. It's what always comes next when you're under the dome. She sees that one of the girls has come back. Kayla Bevins has come back. She's standing there and looking down at stupid Julia Shumway, who thought she was smart. Stupid little Julia Shumway in her baby panties. Has Kayla come back to take the rest of her clothes and throw them up onto the bandstand roof so she has to walk home naked with her hands over her woofie? Why are people so mean?
She closes her eyes against tears, and when she opens them again, Kayla has changed. Now she has no face, just a kind of shifting leather helmet that shows no compassion, no love, not even hate. Only interest. Yes, that. What does it do when I do this?
Julia Shumway is worthy of no more. Julia Shumway doesn't matter. Find the least of the least, then look below that, and there she is, a scurrying Shumway bug.
She is a naked prisoner bug, too. A prisoner bug in a gymnasium with nothing left but the unraveling hat on his head, and beneath the hat, a final memory of fragrant, freshly baked chups held out in his wife's hands. She is a cat with a burning tail, an ant under a microscope, a fly about to lose its wings to the curious plucking fingers of a third grader on a rainy day, a game for bored children with no bodies, and the whole universe at their feet. She is Barbie. She is Sam, dying in Linda Everett's van. She is Ollie, dying in the cinders. She is Alva Drake, mourning her dead son. But mostly, she is a little girl, cowering on the splintery boards of the town common bandstand. A little girl who was punished for her innocent arrogance. A little girl who made the mistake of thinking she was big when she was small. That she mattered when she didn't. That the world cared, when in reality the world is a huge dead locomotive with an engine but no headlight. And with all her heart and mind and soul, she cries out, "Please let us live. I beg you. Please." And for just one moment, she is the leatherhead in the white room. She is the girl who has, for reasons she cannot even explain to herself, come back to the bandstand. For one terrible moment, Julia is the one who did it, instead of the one who was done by. She is even the soldier with the gun, the hacker monster Dale Barbara still dreams about, the one he didn't stop. Then she is only herself again, looking up at Caleb Evans. Kayla's family is poor. Her father cuts pulp on the TR and drinks down at Freshie's Pub, which will, in the fullness of time, become Dippers. Her mother has a big old pink mark on her cheek, so the kids call her Cherry Face or Strawberry Head. Kayla doesn't have any nice clothes. Today she is wearing an old brown sweater and an old plaid skirt and scuff loafers and white socks with saggy tops. One knee is scraped where she fell or was pushed down on the playground. It's Caleb Evans, all right. But now her face is made of leather, and although it shifts through many shapes, none of them is even close to human. Julia thinks, I'm seeing how the child looks to the ant if the ant looks up from its side of the magnifying glass, if it looks up just before it starts to burn.
Please, Kayla, please. We are alive.
Kayla looks down at her without doing anything. Then she crosses her arms in front of her. They are human arms in this vision, and pulls her sweater over her head. There is no love in her voice when she speaks, no regret or remorse. But there might be pity. She says, 12. Julia was hurled away from the box as if a hand had swatted her. The held breath blew out of her. Before she could take another one, Barbie seized her by the shoulder, pulled the swatch of plastic from the spindle, and pushed her mouth onto it, hoping he wouldn't cut her tongue or, God forbid, skewer the hard plastic into the roof of her mouth. But he couldn't let her breathe the poisoned air. As oxygen-starved as she was, it might send her into convulsions or kill her outright. Wherever she'd been, Julia seemed to understand. Instead of trying to struggle away, she wrapped her arms around the Prius tire in a death grip and began sucking frantically at the spindle. He could feel huge, shuddering tremors racing through her body. Sam had finally stopped coughing. But now, there was another sound. Julia heard it, too. She sucked in another vast breath from the tire and looked up, eyes wide in their deep, shadowed sockets. A dog was barking. It had to be Horace, because he was the only dog left. Barbie grabbed her arm in a grip so strong she felt he would break it. On his face was an expression of pure amazement. The box with the strange symbol on it was hovering 4 feet above the ground. 13. Horace
was first to feel the fresh air because he was lowest to the ground. He began to bark. Then Joe felt it, a breeze, startlingly cold, against his sweaty back. He was leaning against the dome, and the dome was moving, moving up. Nori had been dozing with her flushed face resting on Joe's chest, and now he saw a lock of her dirty, matted hair begin to flutter. She opened her eyes.
What, Joey? What's happening?
Joe knew, but was too stunned to tell her. He could feel a cool, sliding sensation against his back, like an endless sheet of glass being raised. Horace was barking madly now, his back bowed, his snout on the ground. It was his I-want-to-play position, but Horace wasn't playing. He stuck his nose beneath the rising dome and sniffed cold, sweet, fresh air. Heaven! 14. On the south side of the dome, PFC Clint Ames was also dozing. He sat cross-legged on the soft shoulder of Route 119 with a blanket wrapped around him Indian style. The air suddenly darkened, as if the bad dreams flitting through his head had assumed physical form. Then he coughed himself awake. Soot was swirling up around his booted feet and settling on the legs of his khaki everydays. Where in God's name was it coming from? All the burning had been inside. Then he saw. The dome was going up like a giant window blind. It was impossible. It went miles down as well as up. Everybody knew that. But it was happening. Ames didn't hesitate. He crawled forward on his hands and knees and seized Ollie Dinsmore by the arms. For a moment he felt the rising dome scrape the middle of his back, glassy and hard, and there was time to think, if it comes back down now, it'll cut me in two. Then he was dragging the boy out. For a moment he thought he was hauling a corpse.
No,
he shouted. He carried the boy up toward one of the roaring fans.
Don't you dare die on me, cow kid.
Ollie began coughing, then leaned over and vomited weakly. Ames held him while he did it. The others were running toward them now, shouting jubilantly, Sergeant Groh in the forefront. Ollie puked again.
Don't call me cow kid,
he whispered.
Get an ambulance,
Ames shouted.
We need an ambulance.
Now we'll take him to Central Maine, General, in the helicopter, Groh said. You ever been in a helicopter, kid?
Ollie, his eyes dazed, shook his head. Then he puked on Sergeant Groh's shoes. Groh beamed and shook Ollie's filthy hand.
Welcome back to the United States, son. Welcome back to the world.
Ollie put an arm around Ames's neck. He was aware that he was passing out. He tried to hold on long enough to say thank you, but he didn't make it. The last thing he was aware of before the darkness took him again was the Southern soldier kissing him on the cheek. 15. On the north end, Horace was the first one out. He raced directly to Colonel Cox and began to dance around his feet. Horace had no tail, but it didn't matter. His entire hind end was wig-wagging.
I'll be damned, Cox said.
He picked the corgi up, and Horace began to lick his face frantically. The survivors stood together on their side. The line of demarcation was clear in the grass, bright on one side and listless gray on the other, beginning to understand, but not quite daring to believe. Rusty, Linda, the little Jays, Joe McClatchy, and Nori Calvert, with their mothers standing to either side of them. Ginny, Gina Buffalino, and Harriet Bigelow, with their arms around each other. Twitch was holding his sister Rose, who was sobbing, and cradling little Walter. Piper, Jackie, and Lissa were holding hands. Pete Freeman and Tony Gay, all that remained of the Democrat staff, stood behind them. Alva Drake leaned against Romy Burpee, who was holding Alice Appleton in his arms. They watched as the dome's dirty surface rose swiftly into the air. The fall foliage on the other side was heartbreaking in its brilliance. Sweet, fresh air lifted their hair and dried the sweat on their skin.
For we saw, as if through a glass darkly,
Piper Libby said. She was weeping.
But now we see,
as if face to face.
Horace jumped from Colonel Cox's arms and began turning figure eights through the grass, yapping, sniffing, and trying to pee on everything at once. The survivors looked unbelievingly up at the bright sky arching over a late fall Sunday morning in New England, and above them, the dirty barrier that had held them prisoner still rose, moving faster and faster, shrinking to a line like a long dash of pencil on a sheet of blue paper. A bird swooped through the place where the dome had been. Alice Appleton, still being carried by Romy, looked up at it and laughed. 16. Barbie and Julia knelt with the tire between them, taking alternate breaths from the spindle straw. They watched as the box began to rise again. It went slowly at first and seemed to hover a second time at a height of about 60 feet, as if doubtful. Then it shot straight up, at a speed far too fast for the human eye to follow. It would have been like trying to see a bullet in flight. The dome was either flying upward or somehow being reeled in. The box, Barbie thought. It's drawing the dome up the way a magnet draws iron filings. A breeze came beating toward them. Barbie marked its progress in the rippling grass. He shook Julia by the shoulder and pointed dead north. The filthy gray sky was blue again, and almost too bright to look at. The trees had come into bright focus. Julia raised her head from the spindle and breathed.
"I don't know if that's such a good," Barbie began, but then the breeze arrived.
He saw it lift Julia's hair and felt it drying the sweat on his grime-streaked face, as gentle as a lover's palm. Julia was coughing again. He pounded her back, taking his own first breath of the air as he did so. It still stank and clotted his throat, but it was breathable. The bad air was blowing south, as fresh air from the TR-90 side of the dome, what had been the TR-90 side of the dome, poured in. The second breath was better. The third better still, the fourth, a gift from God. Or from one leatherhead girl. Barbie and Julia embraced next to the black square of ground where the box had been. Nothing would grow there. Not ever again. 17.
Sam, Julia cried. We have to get Sam.
They were still coughing as they ran to the Odyssey, but Sam wasn't. He was slumped over the wheel, eyes open, breathing shallowly. His lower face was bearded with blood, and when Barbie pulled him back, he saw that the old man's blue shirt had turned a muddy purple.
"Can you carry him?" Julia asked. "Can you carry him to where the soldiers are?"
The answer was almost certainly no, but Barbie said, "I can try."
"Don't,"
Sam whispered. His eyes shifted toward them.
"Hurts too much."
Fresh blood seeped from his mouth with each word.
"Did you do it?"
"Julia did," Barbie said. "I don't know exactly how, but she did." "Part of it was the man in the gym," she said. "The one the hacker monster shot." Barbie's mouth dropped open, but she didn't notice. She put her arms around Sam and kissed him on each cheek.
"And you did it, too, Sam. You drove us out here, and you saw the little girl on the bandstand."
"You was no little girl in my dream," Sam said. "You was grown up."
"The little girl was still there, though."
Julia touched her chest.
"Still here, too. She lives." "Help me out of the van," Sam whispered. "I want to smell some fresh air before I die."
"You're not going to—"
"Hush, woman, we both know better than that."
They both took an arm, gently lifted him from behind the wheel, and laid him on the ground.
"Smell that air," he said. "Good Lord."
He breathed in deeply, then coughed out a spray of blood.
"I'm getting a whiff of honeysuckle."
"Me too," she said, and brushed his hair back from his brow.
He put his hand over hers.
Were they sorry?
"There was only one," Julia said. "If there had been more, it never would have worked. I don't think you can fight a crowd that's bent on cruelty." And no, she wasn't sorry. She took pity, but she wasn't sorry.
"Not the same things, are they?"
the old man whispered. "No, not at all."
pities strong people, he said, and sighed. I can only be sorry. What I done was because of the booze. But I'm still sorry. I'd take it back, if ever I could.
Whatever it was, you made up for it in the end, Barbie said. He took Sam's left hand. The wedding ring hung on the third finger, grotesquely large for the scant flesh. Sam's eyes, faded Yankee blue, shifted to him, and he tried to smile.
Maybe I did, for the doing, but I was happy in the doing. I don't think you can ever make up for a thing like...
He began to cough again, and more blood flew from his mostly toothless mouth. Stop now, Julia said. Stop trying to talk. They were kneeling on either side of him. She looked at Barbie.
Forget about carrying him. He tore something inside. We'll have to go for help. Oh, the sky, Sam Verdreau said.
That was the last. He sighed his chest flat, and there was no next breath to lift it. Barbie moved to close his eyes, but Julia took his hand and stopped him.
Let him look, she said. Even if he's dead, let him look, as long as he can.
They sat beside him. There was birdsong, and somewhere, Horace was still barking.
I suppose I ought to go and find my dog, Julia said.
Yes, he said. The van? She shook her head.
Let's walk. I think we can handle half a mile if we go slow, don't you?
He helped her up. Let's find out, he said. 18. As they walked, hands linked above the grassy crown of the old supply road, she told him as much as she could about what she called being inside the box. So, he said when she had finished, you told her about the terrible things we're capable of, or showed them to her, and she still let us go.
They know all about terrible things, she said.
That day in Fallujah is the worst memory of my life. What makes it so bad is... He tried to think how Julia had put it. I was the doer, instead of the one done by.
You didn't do it, she said. That other man did.
It doesn't matter, Barbie said. The guy's just as dead, no matter who did it.
Would it have happened if there had only been two or three of you in that gym? Or if it had been just you alone?
No, of course not.
Then blame fate, or God, or the universe. But stop blaming yourself.
He might not ever be able to do that, but he understood what Sam had said at the end. Sorrow for a wrong was better than nothing, Barbie supposed. But no amount of after-the-fact sorrow could ever atone for joy taken in destruction, whether it was burning ants or shooting prisoners. He had felt no joy in Fallujah. On that score, he could find himself innocent. And that was good. Soldiers were running toward them. They might have another minute alone. Perhaps two. He stopped and took her by the arms. I love you for what you did, Julia.
I know you do, she said calmly.
What you did was very brave.
Do you forgive me for stealing from your memories? I didn't mean to, it just happened.
Totally forgiven. The soldiers were closer. Cox was running with the rest, Horace dancing at his heels. Soon Cox would be here. He'd ask how Ken was. And with that question, the world would reclaim them. Barbie looked up at the blue sky, breathed deeply of the clearing air. I can't believe it's gone.
Will it ever come back, do you think?
Maybe not to this planet. And not because of that bunch. They'll grow up and leave their playroom. But the box will stay. And other kids will find it. Sooner or later, the blood always hits the wall.
That's awful.
Maybe. But can I tell you something my mother used to say?
Of course.
He recited, for every night, twice the bright. Julia laughed. It was a lovely sound. What did the leatherhead girl say to you at the end? He asked. Tell me quick, because they're almost here and this belongs just to us. She seemed surprised that he didn't know.
She said what Kayla said.
Wear it home. It'll look like a dress. She was talking about the brown sweater? She took his hand again.
No. About our lives. Our little lives.
He thought it over. If she gave it to you, let's put it on.
Julia pointed. Look who's coming. Horace had seen her. He put on speed and wove through the running men, and once he was past them, dropped low to the ground and hit fourth gear. A large grin wreathed his chops. His ears were laid back flat to his skull. His shadow raced along beside him on the soot-stained grass. Julia knelt and held out her arms. "Come to Mama, sweetheart!" she shouted. He leaped. She caught him and sprawled backward, laughing. Barbie helped her to her feet. They walked back into the world together, wearing the gift that had been given them. Just life. Pity was not love, Barbie reflected. But if you were a child, giving clothes to someone who was naked had to be a step in the right direction. November 22nd, 2007. March 14th, 2009.
Hi, this is Steve King, and this is the author's note at the end of the book. Thanks for listening, by the way. I first tried to write Under the Dome in 1976 and crept away from it with my tail between my legs after 2 weeks' work that amounted to about 75 pages. That manuscript was long lost on the day in 2007 when I sat down to start again, but I remembered the opening section, The Airplane and the Woodchuck, well enough to recreate it almost exactly. I was overwhelmed, not by the large cast of characters. I like novels with generous populations, but by the technical problems the story presented, especially the ecological and meteorological consequences of the dome. The fact that those very concerns made the book seem important to me made me feel like a coward and lazy. But I was terrified of screwing it up. So I went on to something else, but the idea of the dome never left my mind. In the years since, my good friend Russ Dorr, a physician's assistant from Bridgeton, Maine, has helped me with the medical details in many books, most notably The Stand. In the late summer of 2007, I asked him if he would be willing to take on a much larger role as head researcher on a long novel called Under the Dome. He agreed, and thanks to Russ, I think most of the technical details here are right. It was Russ who researched computer-guided missiles, jet stream patterns, methamphetamine recipes, portable generators, radiation, possible advances in cell phone technology, and 100 other things. It was also Russ who invented Rusty Everett's homemade radiation suit and who realized people could breathe from tires, at least for a while. Have we made mistakes? Sure, but most will turn out to be mine, either because I misunderstood or misinterpreted some of his answers. My first two readers were my wife, Tabitha, and Leonora LeGrand, my daughter-in-law. Both were tough, humane, and helpful. Nan Graham edited the book down from the original dinosaur to a beast of slightly more manageable size. Every page of the manuscript was marked with her changes. I owe her a great debt of thanks for all the mornings when she got up at 6 a.m. and took her pencil in her hand. I tried to write a book that would keep the pedal consistently to the metal. Nan understood that, and whenever I weakened, she jammed her foot down on top of mine and yelled, in the margins, as editors are wont to do, "Faster, Steve, faster!" Surendra Patel, to whom the book is dedicated, was a friend and unfailing source of comfort for 30 years. In June of 2008, I got the news that he had died of a heart attack. I sat on the steps of my office and cried. When that part was over, I went back to work. It was what he would have expected. And you, constant reader, thanks for reading this story. If you had as much fun as I did, we're both well off.
Under the Dome was written by Stephen King and read by Raul Esparza. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Travis Tung. Under the Dome was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Under the Dome is available in hardcover from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Just After Sunset, Stories, by Stephen King. Read by Jill Eikenberry, Holter Graham, Ron McClarty, Ben Shankman, George Guidel, Mayor Winningham, Karen Ziemba, Dennis O'Hare, Skip Suddeth, and the author.